All right, good morning, everyone. We apologize for the delay in our start of our meeting today, but welcome. Welcome to the February 6th. There's a bit of a feedback. Do you all hear that? Better? Okay. Welcome to the February 6th, 2026 Santa Ana Water Board meeting. We are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcast and recorded. For those who have completed a virtual speaker card for this Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting at that time. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. Before we begin, I would like to announce a couple items. One, right now we have the absence of a quorum, so we're going to move ahead to informational item number 12 once we've completed public comment and the board has introduced themselves. Once quorum is established, we will then resume our action items. So we'll move to item number 12, but I'll begin by asking our board members to introduce themselves. So let's begin with board member Lopez.
Good morning. My name is Al Lopez. I am the former mayor and council member for the city of Corona, and also I served on the Western Municipal Water District in Riverside County. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm John Scandura. Thank you for joining us today, and especially those of you online. I was born and raised here in the Inland Empire. I live in Huntington Beach.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scandura. And my name is Chris Murray. I am chair, at least for a few more minutes, of this wonderful agency and board. Former Councilwoman Mayor Pro Tem of the City of Anaheim, and it's been my pleasure to serve on this board now for nearly 8 years. So welcome, everybody. Once we establish quorum, we will proceed with action items. But first, I'd like to open and welcome the hearing from the public at our meeting. So any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker card, a speaker request. For those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time that item is considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes. Jessica, do we have any requests at this time?
No, we do not.
Okay, thank you. Then that being said, I'm going to move to item 12, which is an information item. No action will be taken on this item. Branch managers Nick Amini, Alan Kwok, and Jagroop Kila will present an overview of achievements of goals and accomplishments last year in 2025 calendar year for each program in their branches. And I'll ask Nick, Alan, and Jagroop to give their presentation. Thank you so much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the board, Chair Murray. My name is Nick Amini. I'm the branch manager for surface water and agriculture in our region. And I'm here to give you a brief overview of the accomplishment of this branch for the calendar year 2025. Let's start with a quick background of what this branch is about. We have four sections under the surface water branch: wastewater, recycled water, stormwater, and agriculture and cannabis. There are a number of smaller programs under some of these sections. All of these programs are being managed by the section supervisors. And the first accomplishment I want to start is right here. If you look at the org chart that's on the screen, two of the cells are highlighted, and these are for our student assistants or student interns. When we notified last year that the State Board has a budget specifically for recruiting student interns, our branch submitted four proposals to the State Board. And all four proposals got accepted, actually, but we were informed that each organization can only get a maximum of two student interns, so we got two of them. There are Krisha Orgo working in recycled wastewater, and Caitlin Ruelas working in general stormwater. Even though their name is listed like this, they are actually working on two different programs each. So we are getting help for four programs. The other programs include agriculture and cannabis and the site cleanup program. So we start with the next. We start with the stormwater program enforcement initiative. We have a robust enforcement initiative in the stormwater program. We have had over 7,000 active discharges in the year of 2025. The federal law requires inspection of these discharges at least 10% of them, and our staff has met and exceeded that goal, and they actually inspected 11%. So. Of these facilities that were inspected, over 1,700 of them, actually 2,700 of them, we discovered these violations, and we had enforcement actions taken on about 2,700. And of these 2,700, the total monetary penalty came to just over $1.1 million. The outstanding thing is that 80% of this amount was recovered last year. That's over $930,000. Just as a background, typically across all the programs or across all the regions, the rate of recovery on monetary penalties averages about 50%. So we are way above that, and we are very proud of this enforcement initiative. I'm not going to get into much more detail. Ms. Beckwick, on item number 12, is going to get into nuts and bolts of the stormwater program and the enforcement initiatives that they have. Moving on to cannabis program is under cannabis and agriculture, one of the programs under cannabis, ag and cannabis section. We have had 33 enrollments. It's noteworthy to say that the enrollments in the cannabis program has been declining since 2020, but we still managed to enroll a good number of unenrolled facilities for that. We have had inspections both on unenrolled and enrolled cultivations, and we came pretty close to the performance targets that we had for last year. In terms of enforcement, we closed one cleanup abatement order that we had in San Diego County. We issued a new cleanup and abatement order for three sites adjacent to each other in Lake Elsinore in Riverside County. We also issued an administrative civil liability complaint for over $430,000. This came before this board back in October of last year. And one of the items, I believe, is to make a decision on the amount today. We have a very strong initiative for the cannabis outreach initiative for the cannabis program. Our staff has presented in three of the state conferences. We also have had two state career events. These are not exclusively for cannabis, but it's for all the programs that we have in our region. These are headed by Dr. Covalone, who until recently was the supervisor for the ag and cannabis section at UCR and Pomona College. I had the pleasure to attend the one at UCR last year, and it was very popular by the students that are getting close to graduating or just graduated. And the UCR event is being held annually. As a part of cannabis program enforcement, we have close coordination with other state agencies, such as Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Cannabis Control. Our staff also attends county environmental crime task forces with the San Diego, Orange, San Bernardino, and Riverside on a regular basis. Irrigated lands program is the other program under the ag and cannabis section. We have enrolled two farming operations last year, which added about 100 acres to the total area that's covered by the general ag order that we have. Issued notice of termination, conducted inspections on unenrolled facilities. The general ag order requires educational events, two of them every year, and our staff attended educational events through webinars that were held by Western Riverside County Agricultural Coalition, or RACAC, and by the San Jacinto Coalition. The other small program under Ag and Cannabis is Non-Point Source. We provided input for different programs in our region into the five-year implementation plan for 2025-2030. And that plan is currently under public commenting period. The dairy program, until recently, was under the Ag and Cannabis section. Because of the staffing concerns, it was moved to recycled water just recently. We regularly do inspections and issue notice of termination. There is not many new applications, notice of intent. We have currently about 75, I believe, active operations of farm dairies within our region, mostly in the Norco and Eastvale area. And we issue notice of violation when the operators fail to submit their annual reports. Moving on to the recycled water program, this is a newer program, and it's noteworthy to mention that recycled water and wastewater programs are basically operating very closely. The staff work on similar sites. Some sites are exchanged because of the type of expertise and staffing available. More recently, we hired a new supervisor for the recycled water program, Mr. Wei Chang, who came to us from DDW. He used to be the San Bernardino district engineer, and he joined us in early January and is leading the wastewater, the recycled water program now. And I have asked him to focus on enforcement action, specifically mandatory minimum penalty backlog reduction. We have a considerable number of enforcement action under wastewater program that need to be attended to because of the lack of staffing in the past few years. We have reorganized our staff to start with reduction of this backlog. On top of our list is California Steel Industry, or CSI, which has a significant number of MMPs, and we are currently taking enforcement actions against them, and we're going to continue going down the list until this backlog is reduced before the end of this year. Another small program is sanitary sewer overflows. We do enforcement on those. I should mention that there is a lot of sanitary sewer overflows, typically when there is a lot of precipitation. I'm sorry, this is not the correct. Yeah, thank you. When there's a lot of precipitation, we get a lot of sanitary sewer overflows. Most of them are minor. The ones that are a significant magnitude of hundreds of thousands of gallons, we take enforcement action against them, and we are required to take certain steps based on the permit requirements that we have. Two of them, noteworthy, are cities of Riverside and Eastern Municipal Water District. We issued notice of violation. The representative came in and discussed actions about how to go about securing the system for not having these kind of significant overflows during the days that are rainy. And they have submitted corrective action plans that will be or are going to be implemented. Another small activity that we have on the recycled water program is helping with the basin plan amendment. This is a joint effort between the surface water and planning branches. And our staff on the recycled water side prepared a scientific report, and this is for amending or revising the maximum benefit salt and nutrient management for the Chino North groundwater management zone. We submitted that back in September for peer review, and the peer review was completed in December. We received comments from three peer reviewers, and we are currently working on responses to those comments. Next. On-site wastewater treatment system is another small program under wastewater section. It's kind of unique in the sense that we typically, for wastewater and recycled water program, we typically deal with entities that are well-established and regulated, such as wastewater treatment plants, recycled water plants, etc. When it comes to us, we are dealing with individuals in public. These are homeowners or property owners that have septic systems that has failed, they need to replace them, or they are trying to add an accessory dwelling unit or ADU to their property so they can start making some money of it, and for that they have to upgrade their septic systems. And we were lucky to have an expert on odds that handled this program for over a decade. Unfortunately, she retired in December after 36 years of service to the state. And we are kind of trying to catch up with the workload that is coming for us. We are training our staff to handle these odds, the more urgent odds cases that we have, until we can reclassify and backfill that position for another WRCE, so we don't end up with any kind of backlog for this program. Our staff also had significant permitting effort last year. One was a tentative order for, it was a master recycling permit for the City of San Bernardino Municipal Water Department. They are generating recycled water, and initially they asked for an updated permit. Our staff put a lot of work in there. This permit was never completed because toward the end of the year, the City of San Bernardino changed their mind and they decided that they can live with the old permit for a couple of more years before they need to discharge their recycled water. So it's on a tentative status. We also adopted an order to rescind older WDRs that are no longer applicable. We have a very popular general de minimis permit that people continue to apply for it. This applies to things like dewatering for construction activities, well drilling, etc. And we continuously issue authorization letters and notice of termination under this. I should say that this permit is up for renewal. Our staff is working on the permit, and we are hoping to bring it up for adoption this year. We have also done enforcement on some of the dischargers that failed to submit reports or had exceedances above effluent limitations. Another federal requirement that we have for wastewater and recycled water programs is the number of inspections that we need to do. You see, next slide. You see the breakdown of the number of inspections that we have done based on the type of discharge, NPDES or WDR, or the type of permit, individual or general permit. We have exceeded the requirements or the performance targets that we had for these inspections. Last but not least, I want to talk about, next slide. I want to talk about supplemental environmental projects. This is not a program under the surface water branch, but because all the programs under our branch do significant amount of enforcement, we got involved with this SEPs. These are the projects that basically the discharger that has certain monetary penalty can do, rather than paying into the cleanup and abatement account or WDR penalty funds. Our enforcement officer presented in front of this board on priorities and criteria of the SEPs last September. We submitted a proposal to the state board authorizing us for the use of SEP funds for a certain local agency on the regional monitoring programs. And that was adopted by the state board on November 18 of last year. So Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, or SCWRP, is now the third-party administrator for funds that can be used for regional monitoring programs in both inland waters and the coastal waters of Southern California, also known as the BIT. It's noteworthy to mention that they are already third-party administrator for the San Diego region, so that gives them a wider area to operate and provide very valuable data on the water quality for us. We have updated the list of SIPs based on proposals from a local agency that we coordinate with on a regular basis, such as SAWPA, SQRP, and OC Coastkeeper. These new projects have a better chance and better availability for the discharges to provide funds for and for the benefit of the people of the state, of the region. And that's all I have for today. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Thank you. Any questions from the members of the board? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, yes. Board Member Lopez.
I want to mention it. Do we highlight these accomplishments on our website in some form?
Typically, no. We have not published these on the website, but there's no reason that we can't.
Well, I just think it's really important, you know, for the public to be aware of the amount of work and accomplishments that are done in the agency, if it's appropriate, you know.
I support that recommendation as well.
Absolutely. We'll make sure that happens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Murray and members of the board. My name is Alan Kwok. I've had the privilege of serving as the manager of the Groundwater Protection Branch for the past 7 months. Today, I'm proud to share our 2025 accomplishments. Our mission is simple yet critical, to safeguard groundwater resources through oversight, compliance, and innovative cleanup strategies. Much of the work that we do happens out of sight, but its impact on public health and the environment is profound. Next slide, please. Here is the org chart for our branch. This branch includes the Land Disposal, Department of Defense, Site Cleanup, and the Hybrid Underground Storage Tank and Site Cleanup sections. We are a team of 22 dedicated professionals, primarily engineers and geologists, who bring deep technical expertise to protect groundwater. Groundwater protection is not a sprint, it's a marathon. It demands persistence, technical expertise, and collaboration. While often invisible to most eyes, our work is essential for safe water and equity, especially in disadvantaged communities that bear the greatest burden of our legacy contamination. Next slide, please. Excuse me, my computer is acting up. Oop. My computer completely shut down. Okay, so, you know, the groundwater protection has numerous challenges. You know, one of them being hidden contamination. Pollution is deep underground and it's hard to detect and clean up. You know, cleanup also requires complex solutions. It requires thorough investigation and advanced cleanup methods. Cleanup timelines could be very long. Sometimes it takes years, decades, sometimes centuries. And it's that way because our cleanup approach is phased. We usually address the urgent, short-term risk immediately to protect public health and the environment, while we focus on more long-term sustainable solutions for the overall groundwater cleanup project. The cost could also be very high. The cost could also be very high. You know, the most straightforward projects, I would say the cost ranges from the hundreds of thousands of dollars to millions of dollars for the complex sites. There are major racial equity concerns. A lot of our sites are in disadvantaged communities, so, you know, environmental justice is a priority. There's also limited visibility. Progress is really hard to track for our type of work, but you know the work is absolutely critical for protecting public health and water quality. Next slide, please. So the site cleanup program includes oversight of 185 sites linked to industries such as airports, aerospace,
manufacturing, metal plating, dry cleaning. Environmental impacts include soil and groundwater contamination. Sometimes you have air quality impacts, so there's significant risks to public health and the environment. Like I said, cleanup can be very costly, challenging, and it takes a lot of time. Now, next slide, please. So for the site cleanup program in 2025, we closed three sites. We conducted investigation and remediation at 49 sites in disadvantaged communities, prioritizing environmental justice. We also conducted indoor air and vapor intrusion assessment at 49 sites to prioritize human health. We addressed gross contamination at three sites to remove, the most egregious contamination to protect any imminent risk to public health and the environment. We also approved 9 innovative pilot scale tests for groundwater and soil vapor remediation. We issued 7 waste discharge requirements, WDRs, for in-situ groundwater remediation. We required further investigation at 67 sites to ensure complete cleanup, and we completed PFAS order requirements at 12 facilities. So we've done a lot of work in site cleanup in order to prioritize and accelerate remediation, prioritize racial equity, and next slide. In 2025, the underground storage tank reached some major milestones in terms of closures, addressing stalled cases, and the closeout of single-walled USTs. So the UST cleanup fund funds petroleum UST cleanup, and the fund was extended for 10 years. So the fund was set to expire in January 1st, 2026, just earlier this month, but it's been extended for 10 years, and so the fund now goes through January 1st, 2036. We closed 11 UST cases this past year with about 80 cases still remaining. A lot of these cases, as the remaining ones, tend to be more complex. There's lots of technical and regulatory challenges, and so, these sites tend to become stalled for numerous reasons. Sometimes you have uncooperative RPs or responsible parties or missing responsible parties. You might have limited funding. There could be regulatory uncertainty. And so to address these issues, the State Water Board, in partnership with the EPA, initiated the Stalled Case Initiative in 2018. In 2018, it was a total of 54 stalled cases, and that number has reduced down to 21 cases currently. 10 of those are still in disadvantaged community. So, this is a major effort in helping us address racial inequities, basically. The other major accomplishment is the phase-out of single-walled USTs. So we have 99% of the single-walled tanks closed statewide. This is a major milestone for protection of groundwater quality. So big step forward. We've hit a bunch of milestones in order to prioritize cleanup, prioritize racial equity, and move our projects forward. Next slide, please. In 2025, for the land disposal program, which covers 74 regulated facilities, we've hit 3 major permitting milestones this year. We adopted WDRs for the Badlands Sanitary Landfill. We amended WDRs for Chino Valley Tank Wash and enrolled 1 composting facility under State Board General Order. We also focused a lot of our efforts on liner expansion and repairs at 4 landfills and 2 surface impoundments. In addition to that, we've been focused on coordination on the El Sobrante landfill subsurface elevator temperature event, which Cindy Lee will be discussing in agenda item 11 today. Next slide, please. In 2025, Department of Defense program provided technical oversight for 9 military facilities in our region. The biggest accomplishments were completing PFAS remedial investigations at the Joint Force Training Center, Los Alamitos, and upgrading treatment system at Tustin Release Area to address methane and petroleum vapors. Next slide, please. So in 2025, site cleanup, UST, land disposal, and DOT programs achieved significant progress in protecting water quality, reducing environmental risks, and advancing environmental justice, from addressing legacy contamination in disadvantaged communities to addressing contamination at military sites, closing out stalled cases. We did a lot of good work. We do have a lot of work ahead of us. In 2026, we remain committed to accelerating cleanup efforts, strengthening oversight, enforcement, and compliance, implementing innovative solutions and strategies for groundwater cleanup, and continuing our focus on environmental justice while driving cleanup and redevelopment of blighted sites, particularly in disadvantaged communities. With that, I would like to thank the board for their time and the opportunity to discuss these accomplishments. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions from the board? All right. Well, thank you so much. Again, we do want... Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Vice Chair Scandura.
Of course.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Alan, for your presentation. Yeah. Many of you may know that when I worked at DTSC, I was a branch chief, and this program was very close to the kind of... Your program was very close to the kind of program that I had many years ago. So certainly it was of great interest. A couple things that I did note. So we now issued 12 PFAS orders. Aren't these some of our earliest orders that we've issued, some of our first orders, or have we issued others in past years?
I don't remember the specific years these were issued, but these are state orders, and we're working on these folks complying with the requirements of the orders. So over the past year, 12 of them have finally met the requirements of the order. That doesn't necessarily mean the work is done. Some of them, there are PFAS impacts, and then we'll be opening site cleanup projects to try to see things through, complete the remediation cleanup.
Right. And the big challenge is just our regulatory authorities have finally come together in the last few years, especially with the MCLs, the PhDs, and then, you know, finally becoming a circle of listed substances. So, and sorry about all the acronyms. Another question I had was noted about the single wall tank statewide. So 99% have been closed out statewide. Do we have any single walled tanks left in our region?
That I'm not quite sure, but I'll be happy to get that information for you after the board meeting.
Yeah. And it's good to see all of those out of there because they were such an environmental nuisance. Major groundwater and public health threats. So it's good to see that those are finally going away.
Yeah.
So we know that there are a small number of single-walled tanks remaining in our region, but it is a small number. I don't have the exact number.
Okay.
As far as the PFAS orders go, a majority of those were issued in 2019. That doesn't mean that nothing happened for 7 years. There's been a lot of back and forth. There's been various levels of investigation from determining what chemicals were used on site over the history of that land use, as well as, in certain cases, soil exploration, groundwater exploration, surface water sampling. There's been extensive work since 2019.
Okay.
But bringing those orders to a close is a major accomplishment.
Yeah.
We can proceed with our own actions as a region going forward for those that still require cleanup activity. And when DDW comes through with some state MCLs, that'll help.
Yeah.
All right, thank you so much. And again, we want to make sure these accomplishments, the full report is available on our website for the public who isn't able to watch today.
Good morning, Chair Murray and members of the board. For the record, my name is Jagroop Kayla, and I'm the branch chief for the Planning, Implementation, and Permitting Branch. Today's item is an informational update on the branch 2025 accomplishments, key challenges, and our 2026 path forward. So I will be covering, next slide, please. So this is going to be the presentation overview today, and I'll be covering work across three integrated programs, program areas, regional planning, TMDL development section, TMDL implementation, MS4 section, and then we're talking about 2025 achievements and challenges that each branch faced, and then the 2026 path forward. Next slide, please. This slide provides an overview of the branch organization and staffing. The branch is structured into three core sections: regional planning, TMDL development section, TMDL implementation MS4 section, and the special projects unit. So this is our current organization structure after the reorganization that we went through. Over the past year, the branch experienced several challenges. The branch experienced retirements, vacancies, and program realignment. In response, the executive management consolidated the coastal and inland TMDL functions into a single TMDL development section that you see there. It used to be two units before, but now it's under the TMDL development section. And they are fully integrated MS4 and TMDL implementation. While this reorganization requires significant management and staff effort, it allowed us to maintain the continuity of work, improve coordination across the programs, and prioritize statutory commitments despite the reduced staffing that we faced. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to brief you up on the regional planning section. The regional planning section is responsible primarily for the basin plan amendments and the dredge and fill program, including the Section 401 water quality certification and waste discharge requirements. This section is staffed by five full-time staff and one scientific aide. On average, the staff processes approximately 80 new applications per year, with 10 to 15 active projects underway at any given time. In 2025, the section processed 78 dredge and fill applications, 29 water quality certifications and waste discharge requirements, orders, and 11 notice of applicability issued. This was quite a significant work. The 78 applications that came in were processed on time. The 29 water quality certifications required, each one of those required individual waste discharge requirements that the staff was able to get that done. And the 11 notice of applicabilities were issued under our existing general order and the general permits that we have in place, like RGP 54. A key outcome was securing approximately $750,000 for cholera control activities in the Newport Bay through the Linda Isle Management Dredge Project. So staff was actively involved in that, to securing those funds. And the key challenges continues to be in this section is a high application volume, short statutory timelines, and increasing project complexity. So looking ahead in for the 2026, the focus is on the three basin plan amendments advancing to the regional board for the bacteria, the salt and nutrient management, and the Inland Empire Utility Agency Chino Basin Groundwater Recharge Zones, and approval of the watershed mitigation bank. So those are our priorities, and we are confident to get that proposed to the board in the upcoming year. So racial equity focus outreach will continue through improved public-facing tools and targeted noticing informed by Cal Enviro Screen. Staff also made a diligent effort to improve the racial equity Cal Enviro screen. So they have been diligently working on that to focus on that. Next slide, please. I'm going to talk about the TMDL development section. This section has been integrated. Previously, it used to be a coastal unit and as well as the inland. So in the reorganization, it was the we had integrated it for higher efficiency and productivity. The TMDL development section is responsible for developing and revising the total maximum daily loads for the regional board and the state board consideration. In 2025, staff supported adoption of the Lake Elsinore and Canyon Lake Newton TMDLs by the regional board and the Newport Bay Copper TMDLs by the state board, including extensive public comment response and technical review. Staff also conducted freshwater harmful algal bloom investigations and ambient water monitoring to support long-term water quality assessments. These accomplishments were delivered despite staffing reductions from 8 to 4 positions, requiring careful prioritization and sequencing of work. In 2026, this particular section is going to focus on advancing the bacteria and selenium TMDL revisions, supporting state board hearings as needed, and moving adopted actions through Office of Administered Law and EPA approval processes. Next slide, please. This is the TMDL's implementation MS4 section, which has been newly integrated in this branch, as I spoke earlier. The TMDL implementation MS4 section is responsible for implementing adopted TMDLs through MS4 permits, waste load allocations, time schedule orders, and waivers. In 2025, this section conditionally accepted the Selenium Best Management Practices Strategic Plan, approved an alternative compliance method under the TSO Order R8-2019-0050, and it was completed. Phase 2 MS4 waivers reviews. Staff also continued outreach with permittees, tribes, and community stakeholders. Some of the key challenges included staff turnovers and limited legal review capacity. In 2026, the section's focus will be the MS4 permit reissuance, compliance oversight, and continued implementation of adopted TMDLs, including the tracking progress under waste load allocations and time schedules where applicable. Next slide, please. So across the branch, our main constraints remain staffing capacity, increasing technical and legal complexity, and short statutory response timelines, particularly for dredge and fill actions and implementation documents that require legal review and coordination. Our operating approach is moving forward to the is to prioritize statutory and board-directed commitments, strengthen the coordination across the planning, TMDL develop and MS4 implementation to avoid any duplication and ensure consistency. And finally, to continue improving transparency through clear public focusing tools and targeted outreach. With this approach, each section is positioned to advance its 2026 priorities while maintaining continuity of core program delivery. In closing, despite reduced staffing, organization restructuring, and increasing regulatory complexity, the branch successfully delivered its core statutory and board-directed commitments in 2025. This work reflects strong staff dedication, effective prioritization, and cross-program coordination. So this concludes my information update. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you so very much. Any questions from the board? Oh, yes, Vice Chair Scandura.
Sure, just a question and a comment. First of all, thank you to group as well as to Nick and Alan for their presentations. Just lots and lots of accomplishments across the branches this past year. So great job to all of you and all of your staff who are doing this work, and certainly a lot of challenges coming up. One question I had on the TMDLs for selenium and bacteria, are those for specific water bodies, or is this more across the, more across the region?
It's for the bacteria for Newport Bay.
For Newport Bay?
Yeah.
Okay.
And selenium is also for Newport Bay. So we have made that priority, and we are focused to get that delivered in 2026. That's a challenge.
Sure, and that's something I'm familiar with since I'm on the Newport Bay Executive Committee. So, okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And again, just for everyone's benefit, these accomplishments from 2025 will be on our agency's website. At this time, we are going to take a brief break because our quorum will be established very shortly. So please take any phone calls, respond to some emails. We'll be back hopefully in roughly 5 minutes, I would think, hopefully. She's close. Thank you. Board meeting of February 6th. I also would like to welcome and acknowledge the arrival of Board Member Alvarado at 10:05 a.m., which establishes quorum. Is that correct? Anything else? All right, good. Welcome. So glad you're here safely. And at this, we will now resume action on our action items. So we'll start with item 4. So we're really pleased about this one. At the December 12, 2025 board meeting, Board Member Lopez and Board Member Alvarado were nominated to serve on a committee to nominate our regional Santa Ana Water Board officers for this year, 2026. So Board Member Lopez or Board Member Alvarado, would you like to make a nomination for chair and vice chair? Board Member Lopez, I see you.
Would you like for me to do? Okay. Thank you. I have a little note here that we did meet, the nomination committee did meet for the 2026 board officers, and we are prepared to submit the following nominations for the upcoming board president and vice chair. And we would like to, I don't know if it's appropriate if I could make the nomination, yeah. But if it's appropriate, yes. I would nominate, in behalf of the committee,
yeah.
We would nominate John Gandura as chair and Gloria Alvarado as vice chair.
I'll second that nomination.
That was quick.
And with that, we can call the vote. Jessica, would you please?
Yes, Lortnander Lopez?
Aye.
Lortnander Alvarado?
Aye.
Lortnander Scandura?
Aye, and thank you.
Lortnander Nuri?
Aye. And with that, it is my great pleasure to pass the proverbial gavel over to my colleague, John Scandura, and I would just like to thank the board for their support over the last 3 years while I've served as chair, and very excited for your leadership this year.
Okay.
So welcome.
Well, thank you very much, fellow board members, for the confidence you've instilled in me to be your chairman this year. Having been an environmental scientist for almost 45 years, coming to becoming chairman of this organization, the premier water quality and water resource protection agency in the region and part of California, is a pinnacle of my career. So it's a tremendous honor being able to serve. I want to thank our past board chair, Chris Murray, for all the work she did in the last, I believe it's 3 years that you've been chairman, and just a tremendous job. And needless to say, I have huge shoes to fill. And then I want to congratulate Vice Chair Alvarado for her election. I'm really looking forward to working with you. Please don't keep that cell phone handy. You never know when I may be calling you. So anyway, we'll go ahead and we'll move on to item number 5, which is the approval of the minutes, meeting minutes for the December 12th, 2025 meeting. And
I'll move.
We have a motion.
I'm happy to move that item, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And we have a second.
Second.
Okay.
Second.
Item has been moved and seconded. Could we have the vote?
Lortnander Lopez?
Aye.
Lortnander Nuri?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
I will abstain since I wasn't present at that meeting.
Chair Scandura?
Aye. Okay. All right, our next item is the consideration of the consent calendar, which is item number 7, which is the waste discharge requirements for the Arroyo Vista tentative track map project in Riverside County. First of all, do we have any interested persons or board members who have asked to pull this item from the consent calendar?
No, we don't have any speakers.
Okay, so no requests or speaker cards. Any questions from the board members or comments?
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to move the item.
Okay, item has been moved. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Could we have a vote?
Thornander Lopez.
Aye.
Thornander Nuri.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
Aye.
And Chair Scandora.
Aye. Okay, so moving on to the items moved and my item is passed 4-0. Our next item is item number 8, and this is the adoption of Administrative Civil Liability Order number R8-2025-0081. The Advisory Team Counsel, Heraclio Pimentel, will present this item.
Thank you. Congratulations, Chair Scandura. On October 24, 2025, the Santa Ana Water Board held a public hearing on Administrative Civil Liability Complaint number R8-2025-0069 against Respondent Daniel K. Muzzetti. After considering the evidence received at the hearing, the Board found Respondent liable for the violations alleged in the complaint and decided to assess Respondent civil liability in the amount of $438,271.28. Upon issuing its determination, the Board directed the advisory team to conform the prosecution team's proposed order to the evidence received at the hearing and present such order for consideration and adoption at the December Board meeting. Consideration of the proposed order was later postponed to today's meeting. Accordingly, presented today for the Board's consideration is adoption of Administrative Civil Liability Order R8-2025-0081, assessing administrative civil liability in the matter of Daniel K. Muzzetti. With that, I return item 8 to the Chair, and the advisor team is available for any questions.
Okay. All right, board members, any questions or comments? Do I see any? As for me, all I can say is we've already deliberated this item. We've heard evidence and testimony from our staff and attorneys. The respondent has been given numerous opportunities to respond to all of our correspondence, to come to this meeting. There's been numerous notifications, and today we have not heard a single thing on it. Clearly, the violations are very serious, threats to water quality and to water resources, and so I feel that this order is more than appropriate. So having said that, do we have a motion to approve the ACL?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move approval of this item.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. All right. So if we could have the vote.
Thornander Lopez.
Aye.
Thornander Nuri.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
I will abstain on this one as well because I was not here at the meeting.
Chair Scandora.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. All righty. Our next item is item number 9, which is waste discharge requirements for the Green River Ranch Business Park. Let's see. Included with this item today is an errata sheet. So when we do make the motion, we're going to need to approve. Then we're going to have to also include this errata sheet if we go that route. So we now have with us our senior environmental scientist, Claudia Tenorio, to give a presentation.
Good morning and congratulations, Chair Scandura and Vice Chair Alvarado. Can we go back to the first slide, please? Alrighty. My name is Claudia Tenorio. I'm a senior environmental scientist and I oversee our regional planning program section. Today I'm presenting item 9, which are waste discharge requirements for the Green River Business Park Industrial Project. That's a mouthful, so I'm just going to refer to it as the project for the remainder of the presentation. Next slide. So an overview of what I'm going to be covering today, first introducing the project location and description, next impacts to waters of the state, compensatory mitigation, changes and update to the project description, and then we'll end with questions. Next slide. Okay, so this exhibit here shows the regional location of the project. The project is located in the city of Corona, just off of Green River Road and the 91 freeway. And on the next slide, please, next slide, is the vicinity map. It's a close-up of the project, which shows the project limits and boundaries, which are depicted by the solid black line. And then the red hash represents off-site improvements for road and sewer improvements associated with the project. Next slide. Okay, so the project site in totals 165.9 acres, and this includes both the on-site and off-site improvements for the project. The purpose of the project is to develop an industrial service development associated with the Green River Ranch specific plan. And the project that we're discussing today is for the construction of five industrial buildings totaling just over 746,000 square feet and associated infrastructure on a total of 78.87 acres. Additional components of the project include conservation areas and preservation areas. That's a total of 80.77 acres under the Multi-Species Habitat Conservation Plan, or MSHCP conservation. Also, 6.26 acres of avoidance area. So these are areas that will not be impacted and avoided via deed restriction, which puts limits on what types of activities can happen within the project boundary. And then lastly, approximately 2.5 acres of on-site oak woodland habitat. Next slide. So this exhibit shows the different components of the project. The area in the light gray are areas of permanent impact. That's to support the industrial development, including the buildings themselves, internal roads, and manufactured slopes. The area in the pink is areas that are going to be temporarily graded and impacted as part of the project, but will be restored and be the on-site compensatory mitigation, a component of the on-site compensatory mitigation for the project. The area in green are avoidance areas via the deed restriction, and the remainder of the site will be preserved under the MSHCP. Next slide. Okay, so impacts in avoided waters of the state. So the project will impact a total of 2.08 acres of waters of the state. That includes both temporary and permanent impacts. The temporary impacts are associated with temporary grading and restoration and establishment for the oak woodland habitat, and that's the area in the pink that was in the previous slide. And those areas will be restored and mitigated. And then permanent impacts total 1.95 acres, and that's a result of permanently altering the site, grading the site, and clearing the site in preparation for the industrial development. And then 0.82 acres of waters of the state will be avoided, and that's via the deed-restricted areas in the conservation MSHCP area. Next slide. Okay, so in order to offset the project impacts to waters of the state, there is going to be a combination of different compensatory mitigation approaches. The first is the on-site mitigation, and that's within the 2.5-acre oak woodland area. So the 0.13 acres of temporary impacts will be restored. In addition to the restoration, the project component will be establishing a total of 0.88 acres of new stream bed within the oak woodland area. So we will have a total restoration and establishment of waters of the state of 1.018 acres. Other off-site or other mitigation approaches associated with this project also include the purchase of 1.07 acres of credits from the Soquel Canyon Mitigation Bank. And the discharger will also be providing a financial security in the form of a letter of credit to purchase 4.77 acres of mitigation credits from the River Park Mitigation Bank. And this is to satisfy requirements by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which also will be issuing a permit for this project. And just a quick accounting of all the different acreages and mitigation for the project. In total, the project, the on-site waters and restoration for the project include 1.01 acres contained within the 2.57 acre mitigation area, and a total of 1.83 acres will be preserved and avoided in a combination of preservation and restoration. Next slide. Okay, so there have been some changes to the project from the original proposal, and those should have been provided in the strike and underline as part of the agenda package. So changes to the project include removal of reference to estate residential, which are no longer a project consideration for as part of the overall proposal. So any references to future potential residential have been removed from the project description. Also, updating references from Open Space General to MSHCP Conservation, and this is to just maintain consistency with terminology that's being used amongst different planning and permitting documents. Also, the addition of post-construction requirements, and then lastly, clarifications to the final compensatory mitigation acreages that were agreed to as part of the approval and review of the application. Okay, next slide. As Chair Scandura mentioned, there's also an errata sheet accompanying the final tentative order, which includes removing reference of a one-to-one mitigation to impact ratio for the so-called canyon mitigation credits. Although the mitigation does represent a one-to-one ratio for impacts, the credit purchase is less than a one-to-one, but the overall mitigation is a one-to-one ratio. Also clarifying that the on-site preservation should be changed from 1.96 to 1.83, and that's through the conservation areas, the deed restriction areas, and the on-site mitigation. Next slide. Alrighty, so with that, staff recommend that this board adopt order R8-2026-0004 as presented with changes in the errata sheet. And with that, are there any questions?
Okay, board members, do we have any questions? Board Member Lopez.
Yes, I'm not familiar with the, CEQA?
CEQA, yeah, California Environmental Quality.
I'm not familiar with that area, is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm talking about SoQuel?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, SoQuel, that is in Chino Hills. So the SoQuel Canyon, it's a mitigation bank. That is an area that's been preserved, and dischargers, when they're going to have impacts, can offset their impacts there. So yeah, so this SoQuel Canyon is primarily in the city of Chino Hills with a very small portion in Orange County.
Thank you.
Other questions?
With that, unless there's any questions, I would move approval of the recommendation.
I'll second.
Okay, and just a couple things I wanted to mention. So we were originally supposed to take this up at the last meeting, and I have to admit to my fellow board members, I was kind of the troublemaker on that one, because in the last meeting, it was mentioned that there may be residential development on the project. When I asked about that, and our staff inquired with the city, and I think with the developer, and they said, no, we're not going to do that. And so that had to change a number of things in the WDRs. Now, one thing I will mention is that this area, it's uphill or south of the industrial site, and it is not going to be dedicated towards any conservation zones, as I understand that.
I'm sorry, what area?
This is the drainage area that's uphill. I often think uphill north, but it's actually south of the industrial buildings. That's where the estate residential is going to go.
Yeah, those areas were still going to, yeah. So as far as the impacts go, those areas were always proposed to be impacted as part of the project because they need to be graded to support the manufacturer slopes. But it was an option to include estate residential in the future. But those areas were always intended to be impacted as part of the project. So the impacts for the grading never changed. It was more just what was going to end up being on that site for future uses, but residential is no longer a consideration.
Right, right. And that area still remains under the control of the developer. So at a future time, they could come back and request approval from the city for residential use, in which case new WDRs would be necessary.
Oh, you're talking about for the deed restriction.
No, this is the area that's, this is the drainage area that was supposed to be a state residential.
It's my understanding that estate residential, yeah, so if there were to be changes, yeah, they would need, you know, but the final approval from the city, this area is in a very high hazard fire area, yeah. And that was one of the reasons why it was removed from residential because, at this point, we're not being proposed, but if there will be changes, it would obviously have to go through the city for approval.
Okay, and then the other thing I wanted to mention is that we do have the mitigation impacts, the 2.57 acres of the Wolk Woodland, the 1.01 acres on-site, and then 1.07 acres in SoQuel Canyon. There's also 4.77 acres, and my understanding is that's not our requirement. That's actually from our sister agency, the California Fish and Wildlife Service.
Correct.
So Okay, so it's been motion has been made and seconded. Could we have a vote?
Dortnander Lopez?
Aye.
Dortnander Nuri?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
Aye.
And Chair Scandora?
Aye. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. So our next item, at least on the on what I have on here, would be item
Excuse me, Chair Scandora. Can I just note for the minutes the departure of Board Member Murray and at 10:30? So we have the absence of a quorum. The remaining items will be informational items only, and there will not be any voting.
Okay, thank you, Council. So with that noted, our presentation by State Board Member McGuire, has that been moved to 11 o'clock, or is he available right now?
He'll be available at 11.
Okay, so it's at 11. In that case, we now go to, things are a little bit, okay, now I've got it. So in that case, we can go to item 10. And item 10 is an information item about the region's enforcement process for stormwater violations with monetary penalties assessed and issued in 2024-25 and 2025-2026. Fiscal years. We have Michelle Beckwith to do the presentation.
Good morning, Board Chair Scandora and members of the board. My name is Michelle Beckwith, and I am the supervisor of the General Stormwater Unit, in which I oversee the implementation and enforcement of the General Stormwater Program within Region 8. Today, we'll be providing an overview of Region 8's enforcement processes for stormwater violations, where monetary penalties were assessed and issued in the 2024 through 2026 fiscal years. Slide. Update topics include discussing the universe of the general stormwater permits within California, specific sections of the water code as it relates to stormwater enforcement, permit requirements that trigger mandatory penalties, stormwater enforcement procedures, and ultimately an analysis of stormwater enforcement efforts in Region 8. Slide. So to provide some background regarding the stormwater program, stormwater is defined by US EPA as runoff generated when precipitation from rain and snowmelt events flow over land or impervious surfaces without percolating into the ground. Stormwater mobilizes pollutants such as motor oil, nutrients, metals, and trash. In most cases, stormwater flows directly to water bodies through sewer systems, contributing a major source of pollutants to rivers, lakes, and the ocean. Stormwater discharges in California are regulated through the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, permit. However, stormwater may also act as a resource and recharge to groundwater when properly managed. One of these NPDES permits is the Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System, or MS4 permit. Regional water boards have adopted MS4 permits to regulate stormwater through municipalities. Most of these permits are issued to a group of co-permittees encompassing an entire metropolitan area. An MS4 permit requires a discharger to develop and implement a stormwater management plan or program with the goal of reducing the discharge of pollutants to the maximum extent practicable. The State Water Board authors the Caltrans permit, which was adopted in late of 2022, as well as the statewide small MS4 permit, while the regional water boards administer and enforce these permits. Within Region 8, we currently have three MS4 permits, one for each county, Orange, Riverside, and San Bernardino. However, as you've been briefed, the Santa Ana Water Board staff is in the process of drafting one regional-wide MS4 permit. Another NPDES permit is the Statewide Industrial General Permit, which regulates industrial stormwater discharges and authorized non-stormwater discharges from industrial sites in California. The Industrial General Permit is called a general permit because many industry facilities are covered under the same permit, but comply with its requirements at their individual industrial facilities. Industrial facilities such as manufacturers, landfills, mining operation, steam generating electricity, hazardous waste facilities, transportation with vehicle maintenance, larger sewage and wastewater plants, recycling facilities, and oil and gas facilities typically are required to obtain permit coverage. While the regional board administers and enforces the industrial permit, The State Water Board authors the permit, which was most recently adopted in 2024, revised in 25 and 28, with critical portions of the permit becoming effective in July of 2020. Once a discharger obtains permit coverage, they are required to develop a stormwater pollution prevention plan, along with conducting monitoring, as well as collecting and analyzing stormwater discharge samples. A stormwater pollution prevention plan includes, but is not limited to, facility description, map, identification of pollutant sources, best management practices, and monitoring and training. Lastly, an annual report is required to be submitted, and they are required to provide that information. Slide. The scrap metal permit is also an NPDES permit, which regulates stormwater associated with industrial facilities and authorized non-SMR discharges from facilities that are engaged in metal recycling within Region 8 specifically. These facilities are engaged in following wholesale activities: auto wrecking for scrap, iron and steel scrap, junk and scrap metal, and non-ferrous scrap metal. Currently, the Santa Ana Water Board authors, administers, and enforces the scrap metal permit. However, the State Water Board is exploring the possibility of incorporating the Region 8 scrap metal permit elements into the statewide industrial general permit, which is due to be released for public review sometime late summer, most likely fall, of 2026. Similar to the industrial permit, once a discharger obtains permit coverage, they're required to develop and implement their stormwater pollution prevention plan, conduct visual monitoring, collect and analyze samples, and an annual report is required to document. Slide. The fourth NPDES permit is the statewide construction general permit, which regulates dischargers whose projects disturb 1 or more acres of soil, or whose projects are part less than disturbed, those projects disturb less than 1 acre of soil but are part of a larger common plan development. Construction activity subject to the construction permit includes clearing, grading, and disturbances of ground, such as stockpiling and excavation. Again, the Regional Water Board administers and enforces the construction general permit. The most recently adopted permit in 2022 had an effective date of September 1st of 2025. Any dischargers who were enrolled under the 2009 construction general permit were administratively terminated and were required to enroll under the 2022 permit. Note that the State Water Board administratively terminated 680 construction sites within just Region 8, as they had not transitioned or enrolled under the 2022 permit by that September 1st deadline. Again, once a discharger obtains permit coverage, they are required to develop and implement their site-specific stormwater pollution prevention plan, along with conducting visual monitoring and, depending on their site's risk level, collect and analyze stormwater samples. An annual report is required to document how that discharger complied with all applicable requirements. You should note that all stormwater permits are required some form of permit application to obtain permit coverage, as well as a requirement to submit an annual report. The failure to obtain permit coverage, the failure to submit an annual report, or exceedances of total maximum daily load numeric effluent limitations will result in the issuance of formal enforcement. These numeric effluent limits will be explored in more detail in the presentation. Slide. Historically, most of the formal enforcement actions issued were authorized under the Stormwater Enforcement Act of 1998. The Stormwater Enforcement Act requires each regional water board to provide notice of noncompliance to any stormwater discharger who failed to file a notice of intent to obtain permit coverage, a notice of non-applicability, a construction certification, or an annual report. If, after two notices of noncompliance, the discharger fails to provide the appropriate document, the regional board shall issue monetary penalty against the discharger. Other NPDES enforcement generally happens pursuant to our authority under Water Code Section 13385. Slide. A discharger is classified as a stormwater non-filer based on the type of information the discharger is required to submit to the regional water boards. In the instance of a discharger who failed to obtain permit coverage, Santa Ana Water Board staff classifies a facility or construction site as a permit non-filer based on our own inspections or the local municipality's inspections. A second non-filer classification is a discharger who failed to submit their annual report by the permit prescribed deadline. Note that dischargers are required to report this information in our statewide reporting database known as SMARTS. This database is used by the regulated public to report compliance with their stormwater permit requirements. The water boards assess said discharger's compliance or lack thereof, as well as the general public via the public reports made available online. Slide. State Water Board also sends courtesy reminder emails to all dischargers who are required to submit an annual report. Typically, this effort prompts dischargers to comply with those permit requirements. For dischargers who failed to complete their enrollment requirements, the Regional Water Board issues formal enforcement notices, again, known as notices of noncompliance, and cites the discharger's failure to submit the required information, whether that be an annual report or obtaining permit coverage. The discharger is provided the opportunity to either submit said late annual report or obtain that permit coverage. If a discharger does not appropriately respond by the deadline identified in the first notice, a second notice must be issued. The final deadline must be no more than 60 days from the issuance of the first notice. Slide. To provide more details regarding the notice of noncompliances issued under the Stormwater Enforcement Act, these notices are sent via United States Postal Service certified mail with return receipts required as being emailed to the legally responsible person on file. If the return receipt is not returned, Regional Water Board staff searches the website to deliver confirmation. As a side note, quite often the board does not receive the physical return cards back, but per the Postal Service's website, the notices were delivered. Regional Water Board staff also makes numerous status update phone calls to each discharger as the final deadline draws near. When the staff speak with the dischargers are again reminded of the failure to obtain permit coverage or submittal of an annual report will result in the issuance of monetary penalties. If board staff are unable to make contact with the discharger, staff will conduct a non-compliance inspection in which the notices of non-compliance will be hand-delivered, and the discharger will be asked to sign for those notices as proof of delivery. Slide. As mentioned, there are two typical water codes referenced when enforcing the stormwater program: Water Code Section 13399, aka the Stormwater Enforcement Act, and Water Code Section 13385. We just covered 13399, so now we'll discuss 13385. A significant element of the industrial general permit is the inclusion of the total maximum daily load numeric effluent limits. For Region 8, that's the San Diego Creek and Newport Bay Toxics TMDL, and the San Gabriel River Metals and Selenium TMDL. In this slide, you can see the yellow polygon, which depicts the San Diego Creek watershed, which is located in the southwestern portion of our region. Dischargers who have notice of intent coverage, denoted by the blue dots on the map, and whose stormwater discharges are within that polygon, are subject to numeric effluent limits and thus the potential issuance of mandatory penalties if those limits are exceeded. Dischargers who have no exposure certification, so the little green dots, or the notice of non-applicability, which are the purple dots, are not required to sample stormwater discharges and thus are not held to the same standards of those covered under the notice of intent coverage. Dischargers are subject to mandatory minimum penalties for serious and chronic violations as they are related to exceedance of these numeric effluent limits. What constitutes an exceedance will be addressed in a later slide. Next. This map depicts the San Gabriel River TMDL seen in the blue-green polygon, which is in the westernmost portion of our region. Although stormwater discharges of this region discharge from this area via Coyote Creek or its tributaries, they ultimately discharge to the Los Angeles region, which is a political boundary and not a watershed one. Dischargers who, again, have notice of intent coverage in this blue-green polygon are still subject to those numeric effluent limitations and thus the potential issuance of mandatory minimum penalties, again, if those are exceeded. It should be noted that numeric effluent limit compliance is assessed per discharge point, per parameter, and how late the discharger is subject to submitting their annual report. As such, mandatory penalties can compound very, very quickly. Slide. Mandatory minimum penalties for numeric effluent violations impose a penalty of $3,000 for each applicable violation. These penalties will apply to specific serious or chronic TMDL effluent exceedances of the industrial general permit. Note specifically Water Code Section 13385 H&I. The discharger is subject to mandatory minimum penalties for specified serious and chronic violations as it relates to numeric effluent exceedances and or reporting violations. For purposes of this section, a serious violation is defined as waste discharge that violates effluent limitations contained in waste discharge requirements. In this case, it's the industrial general permit for certain pollutants. A chronic violation is assessed for each violation wherever a discharger violates effluent limitations contained in the industrial general permit four or more times in any period of six consecutive months. I'll touch base more again on these numeric effluent limitation exceedances in a few slides. Failure to submit a discharge monitoring report designed to assess compliance with these numeric effluent limitations is also considered a violation. Per the industrial general permit, an exceedance of a TMDL numeric effluent limitation is defined as two or more analytical results for any single parameter in a reporting period that exceeded that applicable numeric effluent limitation. Exceedances of a TMDL numeric effluent limitation will result in permit violations and trigger requirements to develop, submit, and implement a water quality-based corrective action report to address these exceedances. Exceedances of these TMDL numeric effluent limitations may result in monetary penalties. Slide. Water Code Section 13385H breaks down pollutants into two groups, either Group 1 or Group 2 pollutants. A mandatory penalty must be assessed if the second numeric effluent limitation exceedance is 20% or more above the applicable effluent for Group 2 pollutants. Serious violations are parameter-specific and discharge-specific. Assessing serious violations restarts each reporting year due to the way that the permit is actually drafted. Laboratory analysis reports collected for stormwater samples must be certified and uploaded into SMARTS, the electronic database, within 60 days of the reported date before the mandatory penalty is assessed. Failure to upload the lab report after 30 days is considered a serious violation and triggers a requirement to assess said mandatory penalty. A chronic violation is assessed for each violation wherever a discharger violates effluent limitations, again contained in the industrial permit, four or more times in any period of six consecutive months. However, before an enforcement action is even developed, there is an element of separation of function. But what does that mean? Appropriate protocols have been established and are in place to maintain separation of function between enforcement staff and staff who may serve in an advisory capacity to the board in an adjudicatory hearing. The prosecution team will issue one of the following monetary enforcement actions: expedited payment letter, or known as a conditional settlement offer, mandatory minimum penalty complaints, and administrative civil liability complaints. Expedited payment letters, or again, conditional settlement offers, are a newer enforcement tool and is exactly that, an expedited or rather streamlined settlement process, which significantly reduces board staff time. Regional Water Board prosecution teams tend to issue these expedited payment letters as the first step in pursuing monetary penalty. This, of course, is dependent on the circumstances for each case. For example, whether or not a discharger is responsive to the Water Board staff, if they wish to simply waive their rights to a hearing and pay the penalty, or have already satisfied the notices of noncompliance, but it was after that final deadline. Now, mandatory minimum penalty complaints used to be the initial monetary enforcement tool, but you will see in a later slide a noticeable shift of issuing settlement offers rather than mandatory penalty complaints. Also in a later slide, I'll explain the significant difference between the two. Oh, can you go back? Thank you. Administrative civil liability complaints are the most robust, aka time-consuming, monetary enforcement actions. The prosecution team issues these complaints for failures to implement permit elements. For example, failed BMPs, unauthorized non-stormwater discharges, repeat violations for recalcitrant dischargers, etc. Now, slide. To further define elements of expedited payment letters or conditional settlement offers and mandatory minimum penalty complaints, you'll see that for a settlement offer, prosecution team will issue the settlement offer, which includes, again, the settlement letter, a waiver and proposed order, which again allows a discharger to waive their rights to a hearing and agree to settle, an initial evidence, which usually, if issued under the Stormwater Enforcement Act, includes the notices of noncompliance, return receipts, screenshots, what have you. If issued under Water Code Section 13385 for effluent limit exceedances, Evidence is expressed in summary tables and calculations illustrating TMDL effluent limit exceedances and or late reporting. For mandatory minimum penalty violations, a prosecution team issues a complaint, waiver, initial evidence, and due to the recently adopted 2024 enforcement policy, the prosecution team will also issue draft hearing procedures consistent with the enforcement policy hearing template. A key difference between settlement offers and complaints is that a complaint is issued on a 90-day hearing schedule with deadlines leading up to an evidentiary hearing where a final order will be issued. When a settlement offer is issued, the prosecution team will, which is again a settlement offer, the discharger accepts the conditions of the offer and waives the right to a hearing, they must comply with the proposed order and agree to pay the settlement amount. The acceptance and waiver must be signed and submitted by the deadline identified in said offer. Dischargers can also contest the violations, in which case the prosecution team will engage with the discharger, review the information, and under very limited circumstances, and if appropriate, will revise the settlement offer. If the discharger rejects the proposed order stipulations or fails to respond, the Regional Water Board is authorized to pursue further liability via mandatory minimum penalty complaints or administrative civil liability complaints. Slide. If a discharger accepts the proposed order conditions and signs the waiver, the prosecution team posts a notice of settlement for 30-day public comment period. If no significant comments are received, the executive officer executes the acceptance and waiver as a stipulated order. From there, payment is due 30 days after the executive officer's signature. Please note that failure to pay may result in further liability, referral to the Attorney General's office, and/or void the offer to participate in the expedited payment program. If significant comments are received in opposition to the settlement, the offer may be withdrawn. Generally, our preference is to settle as many cases as possible, as you'll see later in my slide. We are very successful in resolving alleged violations without bringing formal action to the board. However, if our efforts to resolve the matter through compliance assistance and settlement offers is not successful, then we'll proceed to issue a complaint and bring the matter to the board. When the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team issues a complaint, again, that process is governed by the enforcement policy, the applicable water code provisions, and a case-specific hearing procedure. Again, these hearing procedures are drafted for each case based on the template and process contained in the 2024 enforcement policy. The third enforcement tool that I will briefly mention in which the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team addresses stormwater violations is via the issuance of an administrative civil liability complaint. A discharger has three options to respond to this complaint: waive their rights to a hearing and pay the liability, negotiate a settlement, or appear before the board in a hearing to dispute the complaint. A few of you have been on this board where there were, and were part of enforcement hearings, not only for administrative civil liabilities, the City of Norco, which held a hearing in 2023, but also the mandatory minimum penalty complaint against Wicked Creations in 2024, in which they no-showed. As a reminder, even if a discharger waives their rights to a hearing and pays the liability, the public still must be provided the opportunity to comment on the enforcement matter. Depending on which type of non-filer classification a discharger falls under, the prosecution team will issue a monetary penalty via any of the three enforcement tools I mentioned earlier, via an expedited payment letter, mandatory minimum penalty complaint, or administrative civil liability complaint. For non-pilers of permit coverage, the discharger is issued a monetary penalty of $5,000 plus staff costs. For non-filers of an annual report, the discharger is issued a monetary penalty of $1,000 plus staff costs. For total maximum daily load numeric effluent limitation exceedances and reporting violations, the discharger is issued a monetary penalty of $3,000 per violation. These mandatory minimum penalties add up quickly if there are multiple instances of effluent limit exceedances or late reporting. To provide more insight into what staff costs consist of, is the time it took staff to issue the notices of noncompliance, any noncompliance inspections, discharger communication, developing the actual monetary enforcement action, and management's review. And note that the prosecution team attorney time is never included in the civil liability calculations. Now that we've discussed the ins and outs of formal enforcement tools, We can now focus on the Region 8 stormwater enforcement actions issued in through the 2024 through 2025 fiscal year. For the industrial general permit, 191 notices of noncompliance were issued to dischargers who failed to submit their annual report. Of these 191 notices of noncompliance, 4 settlement offers were issued by the prosecution team, meaning 187 of those dischargers came into compliance without further enforcement. 102 notices of noncompliances were issued to dischargers who failed to obtain permit coverage. Of those 102 notices of noncompliances, 2 settlement offers were issued by the prosecution team. Note, Wicked Creations was issued a settlement offer during the 23-24 fiscal year, and due to their lack of response, was issued a mandatory minimum penalty during the 24-25 fiscal year. 23 settlement offers were issued to dischargers who exceeded TMDL numeric effluent limitations and or late reporting requirements, ranging from $3,000 to $159,000. As a result of these exceedances, 30 13383 orders were issued to dischargers. Lastly, the General Stormwater Unit staff conducted 341 inspections during the 24-25 fiscal year for the industrial general permit. Slide. Under the scrap metal permit, an administrative civil liability complaint was issued to Augustine Metals. This case was later settled during the 25-26 fiscal year. Under the construction general permit, 522 notice of noncompliances were issued to dischargers who failed to submit their annual report, which resulted in the prosecution team issuing 30 settlement offers. 623 inspections were conducted to determine compliance with the construction general permit. Slide. Enforcement actions issued in the 25-26 fiscal year, which is currently in progress. For the industrial general permit, 1,295 notices of violation were issued to dischargers who failed to submit their annual report or failed to recertify their no exposure certification. Notices of noncompliance for delinquent annual reports will be issued in the next month or so. One administrative civil liability complaint in the amount of $50,000 was issued to Robinson Manufacturing for their alleged failure to timely submit 2 consecutive years' worth of annual reports. This enforcement hearing is currently scheduled for the March 13, 2026 board meeting. As mentioned in a previous slide, WIC Creations was issued an administrative civil liability complaint for $150,000. This complaint hearing is currently scheduled again for March 13, 2026. You'll note a decline in the TMDL numeric effluent limit settlement offer issuances and conducted inspections due to the loss of staff. However, one position vacancy was recently filled, and the other vacancy has been posted through the CalCareers website. So I'm optimistic our numbers will rebound. The previously mentioned administrative civil liability complaint against Augustine Metals was settled and adopted as a stipulated order during the 25-26 fiscal year. Under the construction general permit, 248 notice of violations were issued to dischargers who failed to submit their annual report. 517 notice of violations were issued to dischargers who failed to enroll under the 2022 construction general permit after being administratively terminated by the state board. As a result, 472 dischargers who did not respond to that notice of violation, so the water board staff issued notice of noncompliances. Settlement offers will be issued in the next month or so to address the list of outstanding dischargers who failed to obtain permit coverage. For the partial 25-26 fiscal year, per the program's performance targets, Santa Ana Water Board staff have already surpassed the target for industrial general permit inspections and conducted 88% of the required construction general permit inspections. This table is a snapshot of the mandatory and discretionary monetary liabilities issued through the 2024 through 2026 fiscal years. Note that the Surface Water Branch Division Manager's update this morning was specifically for the 2025 calendar year, where this slide depicts the 24 through 25 and 25 through 26 fiscal years. Pursuant to the statewide supplemental environmental program and enforcement policies, a discharger has been assessed a monetary penalty by the board may choose to satisfy up to 50% of their liability by funding an eligible SEP project. If a discharger is located in a disadvantaged community, certain kinds of SEPs may exceed that 50% limit. The Office of Enforcement Director has expressed a blanket approval to exceed the 50% limit for SEPs located in or benefiting a disadvantaged community or any environmental justice community. Of the cases I mentioned today, only one discharger has elected to pursue a SEP as part of their ongoing settlement negotiations, but we are hopeful that the future dischargers will be more aggressively explore this option. So where do the board members become involved in all of this? The overwhelming majority of the stormwater enforcement cases settle rather than opting to come to an enforcement hearing before you all. Of the 68 cases mentioned earlier to date, only four have progressed all the way up to and including an enforcement hearing. However, a number of enforcement cases are in progress and proceeding through the progressive enforcement process. As we regularly state, it is our goal that dischargers gain and maintain compliance with their general permit requirements. And with that, I'm available to questions that the board has. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michelle. Any questions from our board members? Board Member Lopez.
Yes, just for clarification, legal counsel, are we in order with all, most of these guidelines or the guidelines with the state or some?
So the enforcement team or staff usually consults with the Office of Enforcement Attorneys. So they have, there's a separate division of the water boards that advises for these. So they usually seek counsel, and Michelle can provide more details about that. They provide, they receive counsel from Office of Enforcement for the enforcement cases for those. And we try to do a division between our advisory function and then the Office of Enforcement function so that we can provide objective advice to the board. But we do have a state policy that it gets followed.
It was just for clarification. I wasn't questioning your procedure. So, yeah. Okay. Thanks.
And Vice Chair Alvarado.
Just a quick comment. When I look at those big numbers, 1,295, and then we see the supplemental environmental program that gives the opportunity for some of these people to actually, forgo or satisfy up to 50% of, the liability. I think it will be a great opportunity for all of those over 1,000 to listen to these meetings and learn that there's an ability for them to work with us and get these things done. I want to thank the team because I know you do a good job not only informing but addressing these issues and these reports. This is why these reports are so important, mm-hmm. so that our communities know that there's always an alternative and there's always a way to work together and fix these problems in a way that everybody can benefit. And I think when there's a possibility that somebody chooses to go this route, please mention it to us so that we can champion those opportunities and we can highlight the work that is being done to benefit those disadvantaged communities. Thank you.
I can address that, Vice Chair Alvarado. Thank you for saying all of that. The supplemental environmental projects in particular, we've been much more aggressive in presenting those as an option recently. Our past practice as a region has not been to host very many SEPs, but we see value in that. I'm hearing that you see value in that. So we're gonna absolutely make sure that we're bringing that option to the table any opportunity we can and marry up those opportunities where enforcement and environmental good in our region can coexist.
Okay, well, thank you, Vice Chair. So great presentation, and certainly a lot of the processes that you laid out we're already familiar with, having gone through these enforcement hearings, and there, that's really where the rubber hits the road, where you see all the notices and the contacts that the staff have to make and the documentation they have to do to make them aware of the violations and aware of the hearings and all of those kinds of things. And then often when staff deal with the facility representatives or the discharge representatives, the reception from them is often less than friendly. So it's a big job. One thing I couldn't help but notice is just the staggering number of non-filers for the stormwater permits, or for the construction general, the construction general permits, hundreds, and then over in the industrial general permit site, 1,300 violations. Now, certainly there's a lot of these dischargers who don't care, but and so they just try to get around them. But I wonder how much of this, you know, is due to lack of outreach or a need for outreach to these businesses to get them to make them aware of these requirements and get them to file when they're required to do so. You might want to comment on that.
Sure. So specifically for the annual report requirement and the no exposure certification recertification requirement, the State Board sends courtesy reminder emails, at least three, leading up to the actual deadline, permit prescribed deadlines. And before the stormwater staff issue any enforcement action, we also send some version of a reminder email saying, you're in violation, you're required to do XYZ. And then if they still haven't responded by the day that we need to send that notice, well, now they're formally noticed. But it feels like, you know, I've been in the program for 26 years, and I'm constantly educating. I think it's my job, too. But the mentality of the dischargers we regulate has shifted. The concept of pollution and what to do to resolve that has shifted, which I'm grateful for. But we do the outreach that we feel is appropriate. Because this is a statewide permit, you know, there's literally tens of thousands of dischargers statewide.
Right.
And so we do what we can for Region 8, but I know that State Board also supports us statewide with their efforts as well.
Absolutely. Certainly for the stormwater permits, since all of them have to get permits from the city in order for their project to go forward. Now, when I was on the Planning Commission, we always had the standard conditions in our conditional use permits, you know, compliance with all the, you know, the industrial general, or actually the construction general permit and those kinds of things. And so in those cases, there's no excuse for these dischargers to not file all the notices. Industrial general permits may be a little bit trickier because there's so many thousands of these facilities. And so we don't always have those hooks through city permits or other kinds of permits to get them to comply with that. So really, I think it amounts to having to do education to all the different associations that are out there. And
I will note, so Senate Bill 205 requires anybody who's in the state of California who is required to have a business license. So you can, you know, not every municipality has a business license, but program. But those that do, in order to have an active business license, they are required to show that they are that they have a notice of intent or filament type. Okay. Link permit with the stormwater program. So there is a little bit of a crosstalk there, but I would agree there's, you know, the city resources are also as limited. They don't know if they're getting issued or provided a terminated right. number or if it's in good standing or not.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So at least the Senate bill allows for more awareness on the part right. of these facilities. So hopefully that'll cut down on right. the lack of notices. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. One question I did have for our executive officer, I believe the MS4 permit that we're going to be taking up is handled by the permitting, the planning, permitting, and TMDL branch, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And I forgot to ask that one during that presentation, but at this point, when do we have any updates on when we expect to take up that MS4 permit?
No, I appreciate you putting me on the spot. In a previous executive officer's report, I'd said that we hope to get the draft permit back out in January. January has passed. I believe that the timeline is more like April at this point. I think we'll have the response to comments to the first draft of the MS4 out then and the revised permit approximately then. And we'll go from there.
When again?
April.
April. Okay. So, with that item finished, we're kind of jumping around in the agenda today, but I would like to go back to item number 3. We have our State Water Board liaison's report. DDD Adamo could not make it, but we are very pleased to have Sean McGuire available. He's ready and standing by to give a report. And I might mention he was our past State Board liaison.
That's right. Good morning, Chair Scandura, Vice Chair Alvarado, and Board Member Lopez, And I just want to first start off by saying congratulations on your elections, Chair and Vice Chair. That's very exciting news, and we're certainly happy to have you in this capacity for the upcoming year, as you, I know, serve Region 8 very well. Vice Chair Diadamo is your normal State Board liaison, and she unfortunately wasn't able to make it today. So you get me. But for me, this is a nice blast from the past. I think I was your Santa Ana Regional Board liaison about 5 or 6 years ago. And in fact, I remember being in that very room there, providing in-person updates to you back then when we didn't have access to Zoom to provide these updates. So it's good to be back and happy to provide your updates. Now, I don't quite know how Vice Chair Diadamo usually gives her updates, nor what she most recently updated you on. So I'm going to interpolate a little bit and give you a couple updates on a few different items that I think might be of interest to your board. And what I always like to do with the regions that I provide updates to is just say that we're covering a lot of ground. I think your region, you have a lot on your plate. We have a ton on our plate at the State Water Board for 2026. It's an incredibly busy time. When you think about all the water rights activities we have going on, drinking water, water quality issues, which of course there's a lot of overlap between the regions and the State Board. So I'm only gonna give you a couple of updates, but always feel free to ask about other topics. If there's something, you have burning questions on your mind, anything you wanna chat about that is of interest, I'm happy to do my best to answer questions. So the first item I wanted to provide an update on is probably one of the biggest topics, highest priorities that we have at the board, at the State Water Board for this year, and that's the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan, which I'm sure you've heard updates on in the past, but just as a refresher, would really take into consideration the balancing of different beneficial use needs from our biggest water supply in California, which is the Bay Delta watershed. Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers obviously provides water for several million acres of irrigated agriculture and many Californians, about 30 million Californians. So it's a very critical, as well as important habitat for fish and wildlife. So it's an incredibly important and constrained resource. And so this plan's been under consideration for updates for at least the last 17 years. And there's been a lot happening in that space up to and including last week, where we had a three full days of hearings on the current proposal to update the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. We heard from several hundred commenters. It was a very busy 3 days. Lots of very good feedback was provided to us. As we're moving forward, we're considering a dual approach, I would say. You may have read about this in the news or heard about it otherwise, but it's a combination of a regulatory approach, which will be based on an unimpaired flows, so sort of a percent of the natural flow that the rivers see, and making water allocations based on that calculation. As well as a approach that would allow for a voluntary pathway, which is often referred to as the Healthy Rivers and Landscapes approach. So the proposal on the table at the moment is to go with both of those, give the Healthy Rivers, the voluntary compliance approach, a chance, and have as a backstop, if you will, a regulatory option should that become necessary. So that's where we're at today. Obviously, we're just in the hearing phase. Public comments were due earlier this week. So we're just sort of assessing what those are, and we'll be working on those responses and incorporating any feedback that makes sense over the next several months. And the hope is to be hopefully adopting this much sorely needed plan in sometime later this year. So stay tuned on that. Concurrently, we have a number of water right proceedings happening in the same Bay Delta watershed, which I can't talk about due to ex parte limitations, but you've probably heard of them, the Delta Conveyance Project and the site's reservoir proposals. Both of those are hearings that are happening with our administrative hearings office, and those are ongoing as well. So lots happening in the Bay Delta right now. Now, switching gears completely, to a topic I think you just had an update on, which was stormwater. One of the challenges that we've had with stormwater, I think, at the statewide level, is that it's under-resourced. There's challenges with municipalities that they have very challenging permits to comply with, for good reason, because we're trying to ensure protection of water quality. But on the flip side, they're limited in terms of how they can set fees and charges for stormwater. And so one of the ways we've been struggling with at a state level is trying to understand what are those costs that municipalities are incurring and trying to assess their the burden that they're sharing in a comprehensive and consistent way across all of the MS4 municipalities. So we hadn't been able to do that. We haven't been able to do that. Different regions, I'm sure yours and others, have set expectations on cost reporting over the years, but it's been varied across the regional boards, which has made it very difficult to have more of an apples to apples data set to evaluate. And so last year, the state board adopted a standardized cost reporting policy. And the reason I bring this up now is just because we're just starting to implement that. And the reporting portal, I believe, will be going live this month, so in February. So it's exciting. I know it's a lot of work for the MS4s to now adjust the reporting based on those requirements. We did a lot of work to try and incorporate feedback and make sure that the questions and the data requirements all made sense and were doable and not too onerous. So I'm certainly looking forward to that information. I hope you are as well, because I think it'll hopefully help us make better decisions as we go forward with future iterations of permits and different actions. On a different topic, water recycling. So one of the things certainly we're regulators and we set rules and expectations and policies on a whole bunch of water matters. But one of the fun things I enjoy doing is giving money out. And so I'm just really excited about Proposition 4 when that was adopted, that provided quite a bit of funding for drinking water, stormwater, various programs, including water recycling. And so I'm proud to say that last month, our board adopted an emergency regulation, which allows for the Proposition 4 funds for water recycling to be integrated into our state revolving funds program. So that's moving. We adopted the regulation. It's now moving through the regulatory approval process with the Office of Administrative Law. But just as a reminder, there was in Proposition 4, there was about $386 million allocated to water recycling projects. I know that's your region has been a leader in water recycling and water reuse. So I wanted to make sure to share that good news with you. I'm sure there are more opportunities. So to the extent anyone from the public is listening, public agencies and interested in that funding, I wanted to draw your attention to that. And the last two items I had for you today, one is earlier this week, we also adopted the 2026 303D list and integrated report, which establishes an updated list of impaired water bodies, the water quality impaired water bodies throughout the state. It's something that's required by the Clean Water Act. And it's an update that you may recall used to happen more directly at the regional board levels. That's been integrated into a state board process where we work with the regions to collect the data, assess the data, identify where new listings might be needed, where water bodies may have now achieved water quality objectives and they can be delisted and taken off the impaired list. So that process happens. We rotate through regions in terms of which ones are being assessed and come back every 2 years. That process went very smoothly this year. It's, I think, maybe our third or so cycle of doing this at the state level and getting on track with a regular two-year update. So we've made a lot of progress in doing that work. And the Santa Ana Regional Board, your region was not on cycle, was not evaluated this for this 2026 cycle. But the reason I bring it up is because you will have some certain areas evaluated, I believe, for the 2028 cycle. And you are on cycle for the 2030 cycle. And now that probably sounds like it's a long ways away, but it's really not, because it takes quite a bit of time to collect the data and analyze it, prepare the report, and go through the approval process. And so what I learned at our state board meeting this week was that the 2030 cycle, the data solicitation for that is scheduled to take place, I believe, between March and June this year, 2026. So that's actually coming up right now. And so I wanted to make sure and flag that for anyone from the public who may be watching and interested in submitting data for that integrated report for the evaluation, that this, the time window is coming up soon. So it's important to be aware of that. And then the last item I had wanted to share with you today is on vapor intrusion. So soil gas vapor intrusion, it's a long developing, challenging situation. You're thinking about impacts of soil gas vapor in buildings and how it can affect individuals' health effects. And there's certainly federal guidance in this area. A lot of it's not tailored to specific California level concerns. And so there has been a concerted effort with the California Environmental Protection Agency to develop guidance to help align different agencies, Department of Toxic Substance Control, regional board, state board, so that everyone is understanding of guidance practices when evaluating sites for vapor intrusion concerns. So I brought this, I'm bringing this to your attention as well, because the draft guidance is out. It's in draft form, but there is a CalEPA series of workshops coming up here. The first one in next week, February 12th, on the basics of vapor intrusion. And there will be a few other following workshops to talk about the guidance, how it's been used, what it means, and to set just clear table of understanding for both practitioners, land developers, as well as regulators in terms of how that guidance could be applied. So those are all the updates I had for you today. And as always, well, not as always, because this is a kind of a one-off, but it's a pleasure to be here with you. Happy to take any questions. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Board Member McGuire. Any questions from my counterparts?
No question, but a comment. Very happy to hear that there's funding that is being moved. Definitely. We always need additional funding to be able to keep our water safe and our waters in good quality. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for your presentation. And also thank you and the other state board members for all the work they do, especially hearing some very complex and often often controversial controversial items, including the including the Bay Delta Plan, 3 days of hearings. Sometimes they can be very contentious. Also pleased to see that the emergency regulation is going through it for the Prop 4 funds. Certainly a lot of those projects that would be funded can certainly look to our region for examples of how to do water recycling and water reuse. So we certainly have led the way in that. And then last of all, you mentioned about vapor intrusion. Vapor intrusion was something that I worked on quite a bit in my last years at DTSC, and a lot of that work involved working with our colleagues at the Water Board. So, and it's good to see that we actually have some guidance that's coming out that's going to align both agencies on that. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Okay. So we've gone from, let's see, I don't even want to say how the numbers have been, but we're finally at item number 11. And and the next one, this is a very important one. This is on the El Sobrante landfill, a major environmental condition there that we're looking forward to the update on that one. And for this one, we have Cindy Lee making the presentation.
Good morning, Chair. Sorry. All right. Good morning, everyone. Yes, my name is Cindy Lee. I'm the supervisor for the Land Disposal and DOD program. Today, I'll give you an update on the subsurface elevated temperature event at El Sobrante landfill. Next one, please. And here's the presentation topics. First, I'll give you an overview of the El Sobrante landfill and talk about the fundamentals of subsurface elevated temperature. And then Alice actually going to talk about the current status of the SET event at El Sobrante landfill. And I will give you some update about the regulatory responses. Next one, please. Yeah, before we start, maybe give you an overview of the landfill structure. We call it anatomy of the landfill. This is a modern day landfill. No pointer. Okay. All right. So modern landfill looks like a box, but it really is like a cell. We call it or a waste management unit, and is lined from the bottom to the side slope. And to control and manage the liquid and generate when the trash decomposes, we call the liquid leachate, or some people call it trash juice or trash tea, you know, whatever your preference. Thanks, Brian. So here is a enlargement of the leachate collection removal system. And so then the leachate is collected and removed, and we take this to the, this is a tank, leachate tank system. Norman is a double-walled and a double-containment system, and leachate are not supposed to discharge to the environment. Either they can be treated, to a water treatment plant, or used for dust control on site. And when that trash decomposes, we also generate gas. So then you have a lot of gas well plumbing into the waste mass and collect the gas, and the gas either being flared off or generate energy on site. And in addition to all these control system, we also have a stormwater retention basin, because landfills are regulated by industrial general permit. And another element here important to mention is a groundwater monitoring program. So we want to make sure that detect the earliest release, and then if the release is detected, we make sure the discharge implement a corrective action plan. And then sometimes you see this composting operation operate on site at the landfill, and then the compost can be given away to the public for free or used as a BMP, stormwater BMP on site. Next, please. Next one, okay. Here is the El Sobrante landfill location. It's here, probably Lake Matthew, southwest of Lake Matthew. This is a 15 freeways, a 91 freeway. And El Sobrante landfill is here. You see the disturbed earth here. and the southern part of the Corona. It's a location here. It's probably one of the largest landfills west of Mississippi. I will talk a little bit more about the operation. Next one, please. The Elsa Bronte landfill is privately owned by the USA Waste California. It's a subsidiary of Waste Management Company. And the current permitted footprint for the landfill is 468 acres. And it's licensed to accept municipal solid waste only. And here's a map. There's a white outline. This is a footprint to accept trash. But there are other property surrounding the area as a mitigation area for habitat. Next one, please. The Elsa Bronte landfill began operation in 1986, and it's constructed, filled, and closed in different phases. I can see the phase number one here, phase two. These two phases are constructed before the regulation, so it does not have a linear system. And there's no logic sequence in terms of numbers. It's really is like a jigsaw puzzle if you look at it. It depends on the filling sequence and dirt. It's really, landfill construction is a huge dirt moving process. You move dirt from where area, line the area, filled with trash, and then when it's filled up, to move on to the next area. So current filling area is the 13B area, and SET, the subsurface elevated temperature, is happening in phase 8. It's about 2,000 feet away from the active filling area. The phase 8 was constructed around 2004, and most of the area actually has a final cover, and Alice will talk about that. Next one, please. Yeah, just give you some background information, regulatory landscape about municipal solid waste landfills. Water boards issue the waste discharge requirement that specify types of waste can be accepted, and the liner design and construction, and also the groundwater monitoring requirement. In addition, the coverage under statewide general stormwater permit for industry. But there are other agencies provide oversight as well. You have Riverside County Department of Environmental Health acting as a local enforcement agency. And you have South Coast Air Quality Management District manages the air emission and quality. And you have a CalRecycle also issue solid waste permit for the operating hours, the tonnage, and the footprint, and the heights of the landfills, and site maintenance plans. And US EPA also gets involved with the air quality regulation. Some section of the Clean Air Act actually was not delegated to the state, so US EPA actually regulates the certain aspect of air pollution. Next one, please. Well, this just kind of remind us that the water board role and actions. Our role, again, is limited to containment design and construction. You know, our engineers, geologists review the design plan and make sure they are protective, either meet the federal and state requirement, or even better, we call it engineer alternative design, has to be at least protective than the standards or more protective. And we make sure the groundwater quality monitoring is conducted to detect the earliest release. So this is a similar scheme, really, to highlight our role is really to containment and monitor. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to go talk about the subsurface elevated temperature. What does this mean? So there are different terminology you may have heard by US EPA. It's called elevated temperature landfills. And when trash starts to decompose, it generates the heat. And is that normal? And normally here, the thermometer can indicate between 90 to 131 degree Fahrenheit is a normal range. The bacteria is happy and they decompose organic matter, we generate methane gas. And then the temperature gets between 131 and 145 degree Fahrenheit, it's the indication there's some heat generating chemical reaction occurring. But when the temperature gets above 145 Fahrenheit, methane generation starts to slow down, and above 162 degrees Fahrenheit indicates that the minimal biologic activity. So it's an indication some chemical action is occurring. And when that, you know, abnormal chemical reaction occurs, and you have a heat accumulated into waste, and then also the pressure is also generated because the gas build up as well. So I'll talk a little bit more. Next slide, please. So the common indicator, how do we know this is happening? So it's really, you monitor the gas temperature at the gas well. This is part of the federal regulation for gas temperature, the temperature monitoring at the gas well. And you see when the temperature is above 131, you need to watch out. And also the change in gas composition is also an indicator. So you talk about, you know, we should see methane gas, but when you see the methane concentration decrease, you start to see more carbon dioxide, you start to see more carbon monoxide or hydrogen sulfide or ammonia, then you need to watch out as well. Another indicator is leachate volume. You start to see leachate volume increase. And then next indicator is a substantial settlement of waste mass. The normal waste mass settlement is normal because, you know, waste decomposed, it's a settle, is to be expected. But you see, like, all of a sudden, the like substantial occurrence, settlement occurred, you see cracks, and that's, you need to be careful. So next, oh, this one on the right, I'm showing this, sorry, going back, please. This is a gas temperature monitoring probe down the gas well. And you see the temperature start is about, you know, 50, 70. And as you go down the borehole, the temperature starts to increase. Here you go see like 175. And then when you get closer to the, towards the bottom of the cell, the temperature starts to cool off because the ground is, you know, like absorb some heat. So we call this belly curve gas temperature probe reading and down the gas well. Next one, please. And other thing happens with leachate, the gas condensate. One is the leachate strength becomes stronger, meaning you have more BOD, CODs, and also the conductivity, TDS start to increase. And also some chemicals, it start to exceed the hazard waste screening level. So for example, benzene, MEKs, arsenic start to exhibit that exceeds the screen level for hazard waste. And then we see more and more leachate and gas leachate spill. Since 2003, we've seen more frequent leachate spill at the El Sobrante landfill. And normally it happened whenever there is a weakness. In this particular case, this is a gas well. Is probably there some malfunction at the gas wells. You see the leachate spill. Next one, please. So what caused this chemical reaction, or SCTs? There are studies conducted since 2011. There are some factors. Some people say because high moisture. You have a two moisture, water plus, you know, organic matter, and you have this chemical reaction and pressure build up. Or some say this air intrusion, you have introduced oxygen, and instead of anaerobic microbial activity, you have this oxidation. And some certain waste stream, I have the two examples here with ash. This is, you know, the municipal solid waste ash. I think maybe Chair Scandori, it's where their Long Beach, there used to be one surf plant that's just closed recently. That's ash. And also the aluminum iron, or this called, they call it aluminum dross, this industrial waste So I have a picture. This is not from Elsa Bronte. This is a cement-treated ash, and here is some aluminum production waste. Usually when this waste become hydrated, it releases heat. Next one, please. So, you know, why do we care here? Because it has some significant environmental consequences. One is odor, because we talk about the gas composition start to change. You have maybe hydrogen sulfide, you have other ketones or acetone smell. So this benzenes, so these are not good. I don't know if you heard the Chiquita Canyon landfills, they're significant odor complaints, and people report being sick by this odor, so they cannot go out the door, and you know the kids cannot go to school. So it's a serious health impact. And when the leachate production increase, it start to invade the gas well. So then your gas extraction efficiency decrease. So you cannot pull out much gas because it's flooded by leachate. And with the increase the leachate gas product, leachate production, you have to think about how to manage this. Where do you take it? And then the strength, you know, when you have the leachate characteristic change, you have to treat that. Sometimes it's hard to treat, especially if it exhibits the hazard waste characteristic. So it'll be really hard to treat. And then with the leachate seeps, maybe the potential discharge to surface water. And then the rapid settlement could lead to instability and damaged landfill infrastructures. So it could be the leachate and the gas collection pipes become softened and deformed when the leachate get too hot. And then also, maybe when the temperature gets too high, and there are literature research that the liner system will be compromised. Next one. I'm showing this map just to see this is something that start to occur across the U.S. It's about 30 on this map, and starting in 2011. So there are research being conducted by U.S. EPA, Ohio EPA. There's Todd Tolheimer. He now works for CalRecycle. He used to be a consultant and doing lots of research to really understand what caused this SCT, what can we do about it. So next slide. We talked about some of the lessons learned based on the cases happening to the east. So you really want to increase the landfill gas monitoring in temperature and gas composition. So once you have any indications or something going on, increase your gas monitoring. And then you really look into your waste approval program. So really track potential reactivity of the incoming waste with testing, and make sure you have a very vigorous acceptance program. And then when you do have this special waste, you need to isolate, separate from the normal waste, municipal solid waste, you know, don't mix it with the hazard, you know, don't waste the industrial waste with the household waste. And then you got to do reduce the pressure. So either by pump more leachate or stop, recirculate the leachate back to the trash. And also increase the drainage structure to limit the pressure buildup. And then increase the number of gas well to prevent overdrawing. Meaning if you have fewer well, you want to, you know, you draw as much gas as possible, then you may draw the air. So you want to have more gas well and maybe pump not as hard. And you also want to closely monitor the air lines and the seals, site slope, and the cover soil to really just look for any slope failure possibilities. So with that, I think I'm going to end my portion of the presentation. Alice is going to come up and talk about what we learned from Elsa Bronte. And we can answer the question after the presentation.
Good morning, Chair Scandura and members of the board. My name is Alice Nash, and I'm an engineer with the Land Disposal Program. Now that we have discussed a little bit about landfills in general and a brief overview of the facility and the regulatory landscape, I'll provide some additional detail on the current situation at El Sobrante. The Santa Ana Water Board staff were initially notified of the set event by CalRecycle in February 2025. This was related to high temperature notifications for gas wells, which are submitted to the United States Environmental Protection Agency. These requirements are when the temperature at the wellhead exceeds 170 degrees Fahrenheit, and the carbon monoxide levels are at or above 1,000 parts per million by volume. These are regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations. Additionally, we have received frequent notification for leachate seeps and spills dating back to 2023. And I'd like to call your attention to the landscape in the background. This is the southwest face of the landfill. In the phase eight area, you can see where there's vegetation over here. There is not any over here in this area, and that's due to their ongoing operations. In the foreground, you see some temporary liquid storage tanks. Next slide, please. This is a figure of the El Sobrante landfill, and there's quite a lot going on, but what I really want to call your attention to are the blue and purple polygons in the lower left-hand side. The blue polygon is what the current boundary for what has been called the enhanced management area is. This area is about 17 acres in size, and it is when the temperature of the gas at the wellhead exceeds 145 degrees Fahrenheit. In the purple polygon, that is the current definition of the set area where the temperature of the gas at the wellhead exceeds 160 degrees Fahrenheit. It measures approximately 8 acres in size. Next slide, please. So going back in time to about a year ago, in early 2025, the state response, our California Environmental Protection Agency took the lead to form a multi-agency coordination team where they held meetings with the landfill operator and requested some additional information on the situation. There was a tour and inspection of the landfill. There are weekly meetings. All the allied agencies are reviewing the landfill management plan, and on December 10th, 2025, we attended the Citizens Oversight Committee meeting for the El Sobrante landfill. Next slide. As far as Santa Ana Water Board staff actions on this event, in April 2025, we issued a formal request for technical reports from the discharger. We continue to stay engaged and maintain a status of interagency collaboration. We have reviewed and provided comments on the submitted slope stability report. We are continuing to review seep reports and the groundwater data and reports. Next slide. What are the actions that the discharger has taken in response to this event? They have instituted enhanced gas well monitoring and installed additional wells in several locations. On the wells, they have included pumps at 68 wells within the landfill. There is additional waste mass temperature monitoring and pressure monitoring. Generated leachate is transported off-site, and they are developing strategies for ongoing leachate management. The landfill management plan has been submitted, and all reported spills have been cleaned up and properly disposed of with the impacted soils and any leachates. We should also note that there have been minimal odor complaints submitted to either the discharger or the local enforcement agency. And no spilled leachate or gas condensate has left the site. Next slide, please. So Cindy mentioned a little bit earlier about our waste discharge requirements issued by the board. One component of that is the contingency response for spilled leachate or gas condensate. Sections D8 and D10 outline the reporting requirements for these spills, which include 24-hour notification via email to Santa Ana Water Board staff and the submittal of 7-day reports. We also receive the laboratory analytical data That's submitted by the discharger. In these two figures on the left-hand side, you can see leachate that has pooled on surface soils. The figure is depicting hand crews implementing a containment measure, a soil berm, to prevent the leachate from flowing further than it has. And in the figure on the right-hand side, this is a image of a spill dating back to December 12th, where the hose on one of the gas extraction wells that is equipped with a pump, there was a spill. You can see characteristic dark staining surrounding the well and leachate that has flowed down across the bench road. And then I'd like to emphasize again that no spilled fluids have left the site. Next slide, please. On November 18th, 2025, approximately 5,000 gallons of leachate leaked from a previously abandoned gas well, EW1557D. This leachate entered the nearby stormwater downdrain and V-ditch, with a minimal amount reaching Sedimentation Basin 3. Sedimentation Basin 3 is a stormwater best management practice. The response actions undertaken by the discharger in this case were the use of vacuum trucks to remove impacted water and leachate, and also the use of mechanical removal of impacted soils. These materials were disposed of off-site at a licensed facility. This is an image provided by the discharger from the spill. If you recall back to the very first image I described, where we were looking at the southwest face of the landfill, this is looking in the opposite direction. Sedimentation Basin 3 is here in the middle ground, and then again you have the characteristic dark staining of spilled leachate and a constructed soil berm to prevent further migration of the leachates. Next slide, please. So in summary, SET events present multiple environmental challenges, and there is an ongoing SET event at the El Sobrante landfill. No spilled leachate or gas condensate has left the site, and Santa Ana Water Board staff remain engaged with regulatory agencies and the discharger to respond to this. Cindy provided quite a few comparisons between the normal operating conditions of a landfill and a landfill undergoing a subsurface elevated temperature event, and we have provided a summary of those in this table on the right-hand side. And if we go to the final slide, this is our contact information, and we're available to answer any questions.
If I could, Chair,
sure.
Before we go to board member questions, I just want to underscore the takeaway. Cindy and Alice have done a great job of talking about subsurface elevated temperature vents in general and specific actions taken at the El Sobrante landfill, which is located in our region. Our job at this point, and when I say our, I mean the Cal EPA family of agencies that are working on this project and our federal partners, our job at this point is to ensure that the subsurface elevated temperature event at the landfill is aggressively and proactively managed to reduce temperature, reduce pressure, and ensure that the landfill complies with local, state, and federal regulations. There have been many positive actions taken to ensure that the said event at this landfill is managed properly. The landfill is not currently generating abnormal odors, which would be caused by or may be caused by subsurface elevated temperature events, such as Chiquita Landfill. My understanding is that the number of odor complaints at Chiquita is in the tens of thousands. That's not the case with El Sobrante. I think the takeaway here is that we're nowhere near DEFCON 1 with El Sobrante. I did not invite Waste Management to come today to speak on this. I thought it would be best if you just heard directly from staff. However, in the future, we could do that. So anyway, just to reiterate, overall, while we are concerned about the said event at the landfill, we believe that Waste Management can properly manage the said event. That's our opinion at this time. We're reviewing their work to make sure that that's done, and our response will be ongoing, and we'll be completely transparent with the community about our actions in the landfill, including meeting with the Citizens Oversight Committee on a regular basis.
Okay, well, thank you to Alice and Cindy for the excellent presentation, and also to our executive officer for his comments on this, his perspective on this matter. Do we have any questions from our board members? I'll start with Board Member Lopez.
Question, do you coordinate it with the Riverside County Flood Control on this matter? Or the Rinnick?
No, not flood control, but the Riverside County Environmental Health. So there is the local enforcement agency that acts as the enforcement arm for CalRecycle. So there actually another local agency is CUPA, also Riverside County. So, but not necessarily with the flood control, but the different department with the county.
And that would certainly change if leachate, for example, were to leave the site and enter, you know, the environment off-site. Thus far, all the leachate seeps have been captured and mitigated on-site, so nothing has left the property, including the sedimentation basin that was mentioned.
Okay. Then I asked some technical questions. So I did have a chance to take a look at the presentation last night, and I looked at the map of the landfill and the color-coded sites of, you know, where the temperatures are out there. And it looks like the highest, well, there seems to be a very large region on the landfill where you have that concentrated region of temperature exceedances. And then I noticed that, you know, there are some areas here and there where the probes are finding increased temperatures. What are they doing to prevent those other areas from suddenly really, you know, skyrocketing in temperature?
I understand that they have reached out to US EPA, requested for high operating value. That's just allow them to continue to operate these gas wells at higher temperature. And they're continue to expand the gas well, drill more gas well. Normally at municipal solid waste landfill, you have maybe one gas well per 3 acres, but at this particular landfill, they're doing one gas well per acre. So again, just increase the gas well, remove gas, and put the cover on top.
Okay. And I was just writing down a couple things. So then looking at the map, there were the colors that showed among them the extreme temperatures, which were in purple. Now, I didn't see any areas or any wells that had that, so I just wanted to confirm that.
Right. Some gas well temperature measured either at the wellhead or we call it a temperature probe down borehole. So if you remember that the belly curve. So usually the people will argue that in the wellhead temperature measurement actually not accurate. You really should measure down the borehole. So that high temperature you're reading, we read too, like a 275 down the waist, deep in the waist. So normally what happened is there's a lens of this hot mess inside this trash. So that's where you encounter. That's the reading you're seeing.
Mm. So there is one exceedance that's in the purple, 275 degrees.
Yes, one spot. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and then the last question I had, I think earlier in your presentation, you mentioned that when we start seeing these elevated temperatures, all of a sudden the characteristics and especially the strength of the leachate and presumably the landfill gas begins to change. And as we start getting temperatures that get up above 170, 180, and then towards 200 degrees, do we start seeing any impacts on the equipment that's out there? For instance, the well casings or the soil gas collection pipes that are out there, the manifolds, the pumps, and of course the liner. Do we start seeing impacts to those?
Yes, if you remember seeing that leachate spill happened on November 18th, that was the result of the abandoned well, basically made of plastic material melted. Mm-hmm. So we had the largest leachate spill because an abandoned gas wellhead melted. But to answer your question about the liner, you know, liner is way deep in the bottom and the side slope. So we have asked the discharger to monitor the leachate temperature above the liner system. Mm-hmm. So use that as an indicator. So far, they're being monitored every week, the leachate at phase 8 sump. So they're submitting the temperature reading to us. So far, it's about 100 degree Fahrenheit. Mm. It's warmer than it should be, but it's not as hot, you know, to melt the liner.
Okay. Yep. All right. Well, thank you very much. Any other questions? So anybody who's tried to keep track of the order of the agenda, I'm sure you'd go crazy doing that. We are now done with item 11, which came after item number 3. We're now going to item number 13 because 12 came after 2, which was before item number 4. So anyway, it's been a little bit crazy, but I do guarantee the last 3 items are in order. So I now, and our next item is the Racial Equity Action Plan Progress, and this one's going to be presented by our newly minted Assistant Executive Officer, Dr. Brian Kovalo.
Yeah, if I could. This is my opportunity to announce the selection of Dr. Kovalo as our Assistant Executive Officer. We're very excited to have him in this role. He brings a broad spectrum of expertise, previously serving in the cannabis program, but his education background is a PhD in oceanography, oceanic geology, geophysics. There's probably a few other things in there that are equally impressive, but that's all I wrote down. So anyway, we're very happy to have Brian here. He's consistently contributed and made my life easier with regard to a lot of our coastal activities with the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, SCWRP. And I imagine that you'll be seeing a lot more from him in the future. Today, I wanted to have him speak to you on our racial equity action plan update. So, okay.
Well, congratulations, Brian, and welcome aboard. And we promise to be nice to you this first time.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Chair Scandura. Thank you, members of the board, and congratulations to you as well, Chair Scandura and Vice Chair Alvarado. So today, I will provide you with an update on our progress implementing the Santa Ana Region's Racial Equity Action Plan. Our former executive officer, Jane Joy, last updated you on this topic at the July 25th board meeting last year. Slide, please. As a reminder for our audience, in March 2024, this board adopted resolution R-2024-0029, condemning racism, xenophobia, bigotry, and racial injustice, and strengthening commitment to racial equity, diversity, inclusion, access, and anti-racism in the Santa Ana region. Following that resolution, shortly thereafter, in September of 2024, the Santa Ana region published the 2024 through 2029 Racial Equity Action Plan, which included the 4 strategic objectives shown here on the right. Within each of these strategic objectives are a series of goals and tasks that guide our staff in implementing the action plan. Over the last year, staff have made a conscious effort and taken purposeful actions towards advancing the action plan and accomplishing its goals. Over the next few slides, I'll be highlighting examples demonstrating these efforts and our actions towards implementing the action plan. Slide, please. The first part of that, staff continue to meet. So the first thing I wanted to talk about here is internal work groups and statewide roundtables. So staff continue to meet in internal work groups, participate in statewide roundtables where they can share their best practices and troubleshoot how to overcome challenges and develop effective strategies for meaningful outreach. These internal work groups meet regularly, as often as biweekly, and include a number of our staff. We continue to work towards increasing our staff participation and ensuring that every program is represented in some way and in some capacity in these work groups. And actually, moving forward, it'll be members of our racial equity team who will be addressing you, the board, on a regular basis to provide you with updates and the opportunity to hear directly from those individuals and members of that team about their ongoing efforts and accomplishments. What has come out of these work groups and roundtables has resulted in meaningful improvements on how we communicate outwardly. so the right-hand side of the slide here. For example, our staff are continually updating contact lists for outreach, have developed a directory of passive outreach locations to host events, and our staff regularly provide language assistance, either in-house via bilingual staff members or through support from State Board. Slide, please. In addition, all of our staff have worked to improve accessibility, whether through revising and upgrading our program web pages to improve clarity, for example, shown here on the right, outlining the procedures for applying for an individual 401 certification with the Dredge and Fill program, as well as through development of community fact sheets and notices, which are distributed broadly in community-appropriate languages and to property owners, tenants, city departments, and relevant non-governmental organizations. Nearly 24 of those notices have gone out this past year in our site cleanup and underground storage tank program. And our Dredge and Fill program is on the cusp of deploying their own new fact sheet for publication to our website soon. Slide, please. Staff continually work towards increasing our own awareness of the disproportionate burden environmental pollution has on certain communities and routinely use tools such as Cal EnviroScreen for case prioritization. In this image here on the right, our region is outlined in black, and the colors represent Cal EnviroScreen scores in relative percentages. A higher score, shown as a warmer color here, equals a census tract. Those are the individual boxes here. A higher score equals a census tract that experiences a greater overall pollution burden and population vulnerability. In 2022, the California Environmental Protection Agency formally designated four categories of geographic areas as disadvantaged. One of those designated categories is a Cal EnviroScreen score of 75 or above. That is represented as the colors warmer than this orange here. So anything warmer than that orange represents a disadvantaged community with a score, a Cal environmental screen score of 75 or above. Using this tool, we've learned that 43% of our open underground storage tank and site cleanup sites have a CES score of 75% or higher. Next slide, please. In addition, our staff have worked towards being more inclusive in our permitting process and with other agencies, as well as exploring funding or SEP opportunities to benefit disadvantaged communities. Next, I would like to invite Jessica Law, who is the supervisor of our underground storage tanks and site cleanup program, to provide you with a more specific example of one of our community outreach efforts here in Riverside.
Hi, Chair Scandura, members of the board. I'm going to be talking on one of our cleanup cases that's located in Riverside. So next slide, please. This particular site has benefited from our racial equity action plan, and this is just one example of our efforts to engage with the public in one of our underserved communities. So this site has a Cal EnviroScreen score of 90 to 95%, highlighting significant environmental burden for this community. The site is an active aerospace manufacturing facility, and it has adjacent residential and commercial properties. Several years ago, it was discovered that soil contamination extended off-site, in addition to off-site soil vapor and groundwater impacts. However, the off-site soil impacts do warrant remediation on these properties, which has resulted in additional community engagement. So I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge that during the development of our region's racial equity action plan, it became evident that there were areas where we could improve our community outreach and transparency. So this project reflects our shift towards stronger community outreach made possible through the dedicated efforts of Gongde Chen, who's the case manager for this site. Early on, community engagement was primarily verbal. Then in early 2023, we realized the need to improve our public outreach efforts for this case to ensure that equitable community engagement, and we collaborated with the Office of Public Participation, which is now known as the Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs. And we reached out to them to have them assist with and improve our public outreach efforts. Next slide, please. So we took our region's public outreach efforts that were being conducted in an affluent community and made that the standard for all of our cases, which aided in identifying who we should be considering as stakeholders, as well as the frequency of distribution of our outreach material. So if we were notifying city council members and county health officials for sites in our affluent communities, then we needed to be doing the same for our sites in disadvantaged communities. And that's exactly what happened with the community fact sheet that was distributed in 2024. The distribution list included property owners and tenants, local and state officials, local, state, and federal agencies, NGOs, schools, community groups, and tribal groups. And when conducting outreach, we also were considering property use. For example, are there fruit trees or chickens that produce eggs for consumption or surface completion that may warrant temporary mitigation measures such as adding gravel to the surface to reduce dust exposure? So these are important considerations when evaluating exposure pathways. And in order to ensure we were asking the right questions and getting relevant responses, we needed to reconsider our outreach approach. So public outreach documents have included community fact sheets, work notices, and allowing for public comment periods for significant reports. And these have been distributed in three languages: English, Spanish, and Laotian. And these languages were identified using the linguistic isolation tool. Additional outreach efforts have included door-to-door communication and the development of a project-specific webpage for the community to access project information. Now, while our public outreach efforts have not resulted in a noticeable increase in public interactions, the public does seem engaged, and they have been granting access to allow the investigation and cleanup work. And we are continuing to keep them informed at key milestones. Now, through the efforts of Gongde and the shift in our approach to public outreach, we have identified these potential exposure pathways associated with fruit trees and gardens, as well as chickens that produce eggs, all of which are used for human consumption. So I'd like to close out this example by highlighting that we are striving to continually improve our community engagement, regardless if we hear from the public or not. We recognize that our most vulnerable communities are likely to be silent for various reasons. That's why we strive to be their voice, ensuring that these cases receive prioritized attention and regular updates are shared through those community fact sheets at key project milestones. By doing so, we are fostering greater inclusion and meaningful participation over the long term. So now I'll hand it back to Brian.
Next slide, please. Thank you, Jessica. Finally, I'd like to highlight an effort that's near to my heart, and that is our targeted outreach and recruitment efforts at our local colleges and universities. You've previously heard about these events during updates from our former executive officer, Jane Joy. To add a little bit of information to those previous updates, I'd like to speak to how these ongoing efforts work to achieve not only our agency's goals, that is of recruitment within our community, ensuring that our agency is representative of our community, but also they serve a much broader purpose, that is to serve as which is of awareness and messaging within our communities. These events often represent the first touch point for young people with state government. They've been multi-beneficial to us and our host institutions through educating the students on state government organizations and preparing them to enter the workforce. In addition, they aid in development of California's STEM workforce, which is a statewide educational directive. And they've led to a measurable increase in entry-level applicants to our vacancies. A specific example of this mutually beneficial collaboration is our longstanding relationship with the University of California, Riverside. I'd like to highlight a few things about UCR and why this makes them a good fit for this type of targeted outreach. UCR is a federally designated minority-serving accredited institution of higher learning. They are federally designated as a Hispanic-serving institution, having enrollment of 25% or more of Hispanic students, and an Asian American and Native American Pacific Islander-serving institution, having enrollment of 10% or more. UCR has ranked number one in the nation in social mobility 5 out of the last 7 years. The other 2 years, they ranked number two by U.S. News and World Report. 45% of their student body are Pell Grant recipients. 51% of UCR's student body population is a first-generation college student. They also happen to be located down the road from our office. This type of mutually beneficial collaboration is at the core of the Santa Ana Water Board's values and has represented a very good success story about how we can target our outreach and recruitment to bring in individuals who are working and living in our community to work for our agency. Next slide, please. All of that being said, challenges remain. As you know, this is hard. Overcoming language barriers, building trust, all of this takes time. Unfortunately, we lack dedicated and specialized staff to lead these efforts, and that sometimes hinders us despite our best intentions. However, we are committed to advancing racial equity, access, and inclusion in the Santa Ana Water Board through continual training of our staff and commitment to our action plan, and we are here for the long run. With that, I conclude our update, and I open it up to the board for discussion and questions.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you to you and Jessica for the excellent presentations, and we look forward to hearing more updates in the future, not only from yourself, but also from the members of the racial equity team. So, my fellow board members, any questions?
Well, not to put Gloria on the spot, but I'm going to defer my comments, you know, to hear from Gloria, because she was more involved in the implementation of this, so I'd like to hear her thoughts.
Well, I want to congratulate for all the work that has been done, right, first of all, but encourage to continue, include the board. I know several times I've made some comments in my native language, which is Spanish, but I think even having meetings and when you are out there in the field, maybe inviting us to be there so that they can see that there's a diverse representation on the board as well, and the ability to have a face-to-face time, you know, with a community, that helps a lot. Also, if there's a special meeting or even the any information that is out, I visit the website regularly, and I know that now there's, you know, language justice, there's more ability for our community to read, but I think everything in their language, maybe additional requests or maybe a little blink that says, are we missing anything? How can we help you? Maybe that will trigger more comment and more engagement. So please continue to involve us in this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Alvarado. If I may, Chair Scandora, thank you for bringing that to our attention. We will certainly try to involve the board members more often. I would like to highlight that one of the other targeted outreach events that we had last year in April at Pomona College, board member Letitia Clark was actually one of our panel members for that, and I think that was very well received. I know I learned a lot from board member Clark, and I really appreciated her presence there.
Okay. And then I had just a couple questions. So I noticed about the college outreach. So, and we've got three great universities, all of them here in the Inland Empire. Any plans to also go into Orange County, particularly with UCI and Cal State Fullerton and Chapman College?
Certainly, the outreach that we've targeted at the local universities. A lot of it is due to the proximity, but also due to the alumni of the folks that we have here and some of those relationships. We are, however, working on establishing new relationships, both through those universities who can help us do that, as well as, you know, through alumni networks and other places. Riverside Community College is also one that we look to target in the future, as well as some of the other universities in both Los Angeles and Orange County as we establish those relationships.
Right, because our colleges in Orange County have very high proportions, particularly UCI, of minority students. A lot of students are a lot of students are actually the first student, first in their family to go to college. So it's be great we get to them. And then I had a couple questions about the Roar Industry site. So there's offsite there. So they've discovered offsite contamination. And what's the pathway? Is it the air pathway, or is there another pathway where it's getting into the neighborhoods?
Yeah, so most of it had to do with stormwater runoff, I think, early on that reached over there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because when I think about, you know, impacts to neighborhoods, of course, going back to my days at DTSC, I think about Exide, you know, and all the, right. You know, a lot of that was the air pathway. And then the other question I had was, I noticed that when we began our community outreach efforts about a couple years ago, US EPA went along with us. Is US EPA still involved in those efforts?
They are, because the primary two contaminants for soil is PCBs. So the EPA is overseeing the PCB cleanup. And then the other soil primary soil contaminants, hexavalent chromium, and we're overseeing that along with the VOCs.
I see. So US EPA is still staying involved in
this.
Yes.
Good. Yep.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. We will now move to our second to last item, item 14, which is our executive officer's report.
Thank you, Chair Skender. I'll keep it brief. one of my former colleagues used to like to hold tense negotiations right before lunch because it upped the energy level in the room and made everybody eager to get out of there. And I think about that often. So for my executive officer's report today, there are two items that I'd like to point out. I'll have to thank Board Member McGuire for stealing some of my thunder, but he also teed up a great thing that I can talk about, so I'll do that. First and foremost, speaking of our federal partners, I mentioned at the last meeting that the US EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers jointly proposed a revised definition of waters of the U.S. to align with the Supreme Court's 2023 Sackett decision. The public comment period on that has closed. The administrative process continues. We're eagerly awaiting the outcome of that. But the bottom line is that rather than simply waiting to see what that looks like, it's very clear from the proposal that our federal partners are retreating from claiming jurisdiction in a lot of our surface water bodies. And we have some very unique challenges in Southern California with our streams being ephemeral. That is to say, you know, the wet season is very different for something like the Mississippi River versus, you know, the Santa Margarita River or the Santa Ana. So the federal definitions aren't always a great fit. And my staff and I, led by the Planning Department, are taking a look at how we can claim jurisdiction over waters of the state. So where our federal partners are retracting, we're stepping up, and we want to make sure that we're, that staff review of project proposals and things like that is accurately assessing impacts to waters of the state. That means that we are examining where delineations occur for where our jurisdiction can extend to. And there are a variety of different approaches that we can take to that. But the bottom line, and what I want to share with you today, is that we are coordinating with our California Department of Fish and Wildlife colleagues to try to standardize our definitions on a project-by-project basis to more align with what Fish and Wildlife consider waters of the state, which more often than not is bank-to-bank, not ordinary high water mark. And I know that that's a technical detail that we probably don't need to dive into, but the fact is that I've asked staff to take a look at existing and new projects as they come in and reevaluate where we delineate where our waters are. And our intent is to make sure that we maximize the protection of our waters of the state, and where mitigation is necessary, we'll take that into account. So more to come on that. I wanted to let you know that that's one of the things we're working on. The other thing, and this is a bit more fun, the Chino Basin Program. So I've spent a lot of my career working on Chino Basin groundwater issues. The Chino Basin program is an effort being led by the Inland Empire Utilities Agency, which is one of the largest water wholesalers in our region. It's a comprehensive initiative to enhance local water supply, enhance resilience, improve groundwater quality, and reduce reliance on imported water. There are three main objectives to the Chino Basin program: to develop local water supplies and buffer against imported water constraints during dry years, treat and recharge water to address contamination from salts, nitrates, and other pollutants, and to provide ecosystem benefits in Northern California via the State Water Project supply retention. So the reason that I bring this up, Board Member McGuire talked about the Bay Delta Plan. As you know, it's a very contentious issue. Managing the Delta is very difficult. The plan has a lot of proponents and opponents. But even way down here, we can play a role in that. And the Chino Basin program, which is about $1 billion in infrastructure to recharge imported water, supplement that with stormwater, and put approximately 10,000 acre feet per year of recycled water into our groundwater basins. Now, through an exchange and in-lieu deliveries of that water, the Chino Basin program proposes to offset takes from the Delta during periods when the Delta is particularly vulnerable, meaning that Metropolitan Water District and other water wholesalers can take water from the Chino Basin that has been, you know, previously recharged and accounted for, rather than taking that water out of the Delta. We think that, you know, while it's a minor part of the overall Bay Delta situation, we think that it is a significant contribution to helping the state as a whole and the State Water Project as a whole. So, with your concurrence, I would like to have Inland Empire Utilities Agency come and speak to the board, perhaps at our June meeting, to give you an in-depth information item on the proposed project, what exists, what's still being built out, and how that $1 billion is procured and spent. I think it would be really interesting. And so if you're on board, I'll be happy to put that on an agenda in the future.
I see heads nodding, so I think it would be a great thing to hear about. And it is interesting with the perspective that this could offset, you know, the need to take Bay Delta water. Now, one question that might be coming up, because this is really hitting the news, and that is the Colorado River. And the fact the negotiations are breaking down, and we could, if the federal government steps in, we could take a reduced allocation of water in California. And I don't know how much water IEUA takes from the Colorado River. So
I'd be happy to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, or have them talk about that as well. So
absolutely. And I think that's it for this meeting. Happy to take questions, and of course I'll have more for you next meeting.
Okay. Any questions for Are you? Okay, well, this brings us to the last item, item 15, and that item is definitely in order. So our board member communications.
I'm going to pass to the next board meeting.
Well, I just want to say thank you to our former chair, past chair, Chris Murray, for all the work, all the dedication, all the support. And welcome our new chair, and thank them again in advance for all the support, thank the trust and the support as vice chair. Thank staff for all the help that is always there available, and all the information and great presentations. I also want to say welcome to our assistant executive officer, Dr. Cavalton. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you for the great presentation. I look forward to working with you and being out there, reaching out to our communities. And for the record, I was here in December. I have my notes, and I'm trying to read my notes as I was sitting down late. I apologize for being late. Traffic really got me today. But I was here in December. I just wanted to make that correction. It was October where I wasn't present. And thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of the day.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the City of Loma Linda for making their facilities here available, this very fine council chambers and all the equipment that is necessary to be able to not only record our meetings, but also transmit it to our audience. I wanted to report to the board that I, along with our executive officer and new assistant executive officer, attended the 50th anniversary celebration for SOPA, which was held a couple weeks ago near Riverside. SOPA, of course, consists of the five major water districts in the region. They came together as an authority 50 years ago. It all followed a lawsuit, the decades of litigation over the use of the Santa Ana River water. And so it was quite an event. One thing that I especially enjoyed was once again reconnecting with our previous executive officer, Kurt Berchtold. My gosh, I've known him for about 35 years, and I can't remember. I for a second lost his name, so that's senioritis maybe. But it was great to see him. Kurt was one of the finest people I ever dealt with in my time in state service, and it was always a tremendous pleasure to work with him, and so it was great to see him once again. One of my priorities as board chair is I want to try to see what we can do to try to fill vacancies on the board. Ever since I come to this board, there's always been one vacancy. In fact, for a while, I think it was about a year or so, we actually had two vacancies before Board Member Lopez came on board. And so it is very important to make sure that we fill those vacancies, especially avoid the quorum problems the quorum problems that we can have, especially in making the decisions. And then if this definitely we want like this to go in the minutes, we've got a pretty heavy calendar this year. Two and probably three next meetings we're going to have enforcement hearings. The enforcement hearings, as you know, entail a huge amount of time, both from our prosecution and advisory teams, all the documents that have to be compiled and the preparation for those hearings. So it's very important that all of us on the board, you know, keep those Fridays open so that we can sure we have, especially have at least four members present, because that really can create problems if we don't have enough board members present. And then the other thing, of course, as we talked about a little bit earlier, we're going to be taking up the regional MS4 permit. That is very high profile. It's going to be, I expect, to be a very heavily attended meeting, probably press coverage. So definitely we make sure we have we keep those dates open and be present to the fullest extent possible. So with that, seeing no more communications, I hereby close the meeting. Thank you. Adjourn the meeting.